The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 10, titled Fire and Blood. I almost said Blood and Fire.
Got a little bit of both.
I got a little bloodlust going this week. what did you think of this episode?
It was your stereotypical Game of Thrones Episode 10, where it just really gets you amped up for the next season. I remember podcasting this episode and thinking about all the possibilities of like ranging in force and Dany with dragons and Rob King in the North, and like, man, seems like there's infinite possibilities for storylines and where they could go. And, you know, I was probably wrong about nine tenths of them. But I thought, as a thing, that the last episode is about crushing the viewer's hope, this episode is about stoking it. Mm-hmm. And I think it does a great job. What about you?
Yeah, I feel roughly the same. I come away with this, with the feeling that season two is really going to get off to a good start. And we're going to have a lot of cool stuff to watch. Maybe some possible encounters with the whites up north. Who knows what the fuck Dany's going to do with dragons. I mean, they're little baby dragons. It's not like they're going to burn anybody alive or anything with fire or acid or whatever they shoot.
Right.
But I don't know. That seems like it will be interesting sometime in the future.
This is really the first episode, if you ignore, I guess, the ice zombies. But this is the first episode where the fantasy kind of comes out from behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Like, up until now, it's been a gritty, political little drama that just happened to be set in a fictionalized version of the Middle Ages. Now the dragons come out from behind the kimono.
And the witchcraft.
And the witchcraft and the blood magic. And like I said, it's never not been a part of the show, because it opens up with ice zombies, you know, resurrecting the dead. And we got a little dose of that a couple episodes back. But I feel like this is the first time where it's like, it's too late. All you people that got sucked in with the gritty political drama, it's too late. Here's dragons. Dragons into cornflakes.
Yeah, I was one of those people. I'm at this point, I'm not really a fan of that dragon storyline. Like, it's not doing it for me. Dragons are like a little bit, I feel like I give them a little more leeway than most fantasy stuff,
because at least
they're just fucking cool.
Yeah.
Well,
I was going to say that. That's what I guess I like about fantasy, is that every once in a while you get the taste of the awesome impossible, and that's, you know, that sets it apart from your, you know, House of Cards, which is essentially Game of Thrones minus the dragons.
Right.
And it's, I have to say, the poorer for it.
Okay.
I could use a dragon or two in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, imagine if Kevin Spacey had dragons.
On the other hand, Game of Thrones has no Crypto Putin.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean,
there's really no character comparable.
No. So, but yeah, otherwise it's a pretty much one-to-one. But yeah, no, that's I think why I watch fantasy stuff, is every once in a while, you know, you get a heightened reality that kind of stirs something the way that depictions of more mundane things don't, for me anyway.
Yeah. Well, the dragons are doing it for me a little bit. The Drogo witchcraft thing, not so much.
Okay.
Like, I'm very uninterested in that part of the whole story here.
Right on.
I'm super interested in what's going to happen north of the wall with Jon and Gior and essentially the entire Night's Watch. Like, that might be a mistake. I guess we'll talk about it when we get there. But that could lead to some cool stuff. And then Tyrion going back to King's Landing to be Hand of the King.
I mentioned, that's the one I meant to hit, like the fact that if I remember thinking at the end of season one, like, shit, Sean Bean was the star of the show. He was the Hand of the King. He was like the main focus of season one. Tyrion was my favorite character in season one.
Yeah.
He's going to be the star of season two. Fuck yes.
Awesome. That's
probably the most exciting thing. Like, I've got a taste of what he can do. And like, he's really great in his dad's war camp here, where he smashes the thing and like reveals them for all being naive fools.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, get him up in King's Landing. Bring that boy king to heel.
Uh-huh.
Bring the girl queen to heel for that matter. Do it. Do it, man.
Yeah. That's really exciting. And especially like when you mix him and Varys and Littlefinger.
Right.
Like, the possibilities are just endless, and I'm loving it.
Because, like, you know, we talked about our frustration as a viewer watching Ned kind of ineptly and tragically navigate the corridors of power at King's Landing.
Right.
And we never really talk about the frustration that maybe Varys especially and maybe Littlefinger felt about dealing with this guy who's so obtuse. But, like, you throw Tyrion into the mix, and, like, oh, my God, that's going to be amazing, like a person that can play the intrigue as well as the intriguers,
right?
That's the promise of things to come.
Why don't we get into the recap?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Yeah, we're starting to do the preview cast for season two.
Right. So we start off with the aftermath of Ned's beheading, and Yoren's out there. He snatches up Arya, calls her a boy several times, takes her out of the crowd and cuts her hair, and then says, "I'm taking you north. You're coming with me." I guess to go to the wall?
Yeah.
Seems like it, or at least head that direction out of King's Landing.
Right.
Get her out of immediate danger.
He could drop her off at Winterfell, I suppose.
Yeah.
That'd be what I would be looking to do if I was Yoren.
Mm-hmm. Bran retraces the steps of his crypt dream with the help of Asha. He's not actually having a dream here. This is real life. He tells her the histories of the Starks down in the crypts and finds Ned's spot in the crypts empty, even though he saw him in his dream last night. And then Rickon comes out of the shadows with Shaggy Dog barking and growling and tells Bran, "I saw Ned last night too. He was down here." When they come out of the crypts, Lewin has some real bad news about Ned.
Mm-hmm. Almost prophetic dream. Interesting.
Yeah, and they're both having it too, right? Like, yeah. I don't know if they're having the exact same dream.
Right.
But they are having, they're both seeing their father down there in the crypts.
Yeah, roughly the same time. Very intriguing. Very intriguing.
I don't know what that says about the Starks, but.
Well, who could say?
Who can say? Catelyn hears the news about Ned and goes into the woods to cry. She finds Rob out there ruining his sword against a tree, and he promises to kill all the Lannisters, and Catelyn says, well, we gotta get the girls back first.
I like that they make you think that she's going to give the real politic of, like, well, this is the way the world works. You're going to have to grow up, and then she's like, you know, they have your sisters. We need to get them back. Then we'll kill every last motherfucker. And that's like, yeah, like I think a non-Game of Thrones show would leave us without the mother adding to the, oh yeah, no, we're going to kill them all too. But Game of Thrones takes an extra mile to give you the real politic. And then, yes, we are also going to kill every last shit at King's Landing.
Yep. And it's nice, I guess, there's a comparison to be made here between how Tywin responds to Jaime's capture and how Catelyn responds to Ned's beheading. Because I think they're both...
All right, make that comparison.
I think that maybe they're both setting up for the same goal. We're going to get our family members back and then kill every last Stark/Lannister.
Flip all the tables, yeah.
Right. The war is really on both sides now, whereas before, it's kind of just on the Snow side, the Stark side. Now it's kind of you know, with the capture of Jaime, bled over to the Lannister side.
Did it seem like to you that there was maybe a possibility for a Cold War, like with significant hostages mm-hmm. on both sides? Like, you don't have Daddy Lannister and you don't have Daddy Stark, but you do have the sisters and you have the brother. Yeah. Like, that seems two of the sisters might be worth the Jaime. Like, maybe that there is a way where these guys would kind of, like, more slowly duel and deal through proxies and at this stage, or do you think it's going to be all-out war no matter what?
I just think the sticking point is going to be Ned's head. Mm. Ned's dead, and I don't think anybody's cool with that,
yeah.
regardless of how many daughters and sons they get back.
Yeah. What if, well, nah, I'm not going to play a game of what if. That's fan fiction-y. Don't truck with that here in this podcast.
If Ned was still alive, yeah, I definitely think there's an opportunity.
No, I was thinking, like, if Tywin died. Like, imagine if Tywin died in a battle and Jaime was captured.
Okay, if they had, like, beheaded Tywin.
But that's like, I mean, that's like saying that you would sacrifice your king for a queen, to take the other person's queen. Because I like Ned. Mm-hmm. Ned's no fucking Tywin Lannister.
Sure.
Like, maybe if it came to all-out war, that would be interesting, but as far as trying to get your allies whipped up and you know, yeah. keeping the neutrals in play, like, Tywin's just going to... I don't see any way that Tywin doesn't outfight, you know, Ned, the Stark army and Ned as long as he's still alive, but if both of them are dead, that's, like, way in the Stark's favor. Because you got right. then you got Joffrey yeah. and Jaime and Joffrey and Cersei that have to ride to the rescue,
mm-hmm.
and I don't feel good about that.
Yeah,
despite what Maester Pycelle says about Joffrey's keen military mind.
Oh God, yeah, I don't buy that for one second.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be an entirely different battle for sure. You would have like King's Landing has a bunch of wild cards in it too, like Littlefinger and sure. Varys. I mean, yeah. if we believe what Varys says about his intentions, he's there sowing chaos in the land and trying to undermine the king here. So, like, I think it would be a real uphill battle without Tywin for sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see. But yeah, there's like I said, it would be interesting to see what. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, it's not interesting. It's not interesting to conceive of all possible alternate realities where things could have happened. And that's something you do when you've been waiting for 6 years for a book. So
sure.
Let's move on.
Okay. So Catelyn here is, wait, we already did this. There's a bard in the throne room singing a very insulting song about King Robert. Very funny. Very good song. I enjoyed it immensely. And I think actually Cersei enjoyed it immensely as well.
You do?
She's over there smiling. She's cracking a smile about
She's wearing a look of distaste.
She didn't like Robert.
Yeah, but how does she feel about it in the context of this being her son and this being kind of like... I mean, you're right. Like, I think if I was Cersei, I'd be flattered in like, this boar's less murderous than the lion in my bed. Like,
mm-hmm.
that makes you sound like a badass.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's kind of, yeah.
I think she dug the song. It's just okay. Joffrey, you know, he still thinks Robert's his father, and mm-hmm. he loved his father, and that's...
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm not entirely sure how much of this is him loving his father, which we've talked about the kind of complicated relationship that probably any teenage boy has with his king father.
Sure.
Especially when you got one like Robert. But also, like, I think he just enjoys cruelty.
He does.
So, like, this is an excuse, like, hey, I can do something cruel and unusual and on the pretext of maintaining justice in the realm. Yes, I will do that thing.
Sure.
I mean, if he's smart, like, this guy's super, super clever. I would pay him to sing songs about my enemies. Hey, go out, sit in Baylor Square and talk about what a dumb fuck Ned Stark was. And also make sure you cast aspersions about... Right, go easy on Sansa because I'm supposed to marry her, but like that's what a Tywin Lannister would do.
So Joffrey doesn't like it. He gives the guy a choice between keeping his hands or his tongue. Guy chooses his hands, so they pull his tongue out, and Joffrey invites Sansa to take a walk with him. I guess Ilyn Payne just constantly carries the tongue pullers.
I think he's ready to. I think he's ready to torture at a moment's notice. He's ready to behead, torture.
That's a pretty standard piece of equipment in the torture kit, right?
Yeah, you got pliers, you got knife.
Right.
He's probably got some bamboo shoots in his utility belt.
Yep.
Like, he's just a Batman.
Got some hammers,
of pain.
Maybe, for smashing.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, some small, like, ball peens.
Ball peen, tinker's hammer, yeah. Right. You know, the kneecaps shatter instantly with those things.
And something sharp and pointy. He obviously has his knife with him.
Yep. Then did you get the fact that Sir Ilan has no tongue?
No, I didn't.
That's why, I mean, this is something they make manifest in the books, but that's why Joffrey said it's only fitting for you to do it, because
that makes sense.
Sir Ilan got his tongue pulled out, boasting about how awesome Tywin Lannister was, or in front of the wrong people, and Tywin rewarded him for his loyalty and for the loss of his tongue with a prominent position in his household. So
getting revenge on all the bad people.
Yeah. Podrick Payne is one of his relatives. Famously has his tongue.
Who is Podrick Payne?
I have no idea
who Podrick
Payne
is.
You guys are in for the legend of Podrick. Just wait. Be on tinderhooks about this Podrick showing up.
Yep. Never heard of him. Joffrey takes Sansa to see her father's head on a spike. She doesn't exactly react like Joffrey wants, so he has Sir Meryn Trant smack her a couple times. Sansa approaches Joffrey to try and throw him off the platform, but the Hound stops her. And then after Joffrey leaves, the Hound advises Sansa to give Joffrey what he wants. Save herself some pain.
It's interesting to me that the Hound seemed like he was in tune with what Sansa is feeling, which makes sense. Like, he was the person tormented by an implacable foe that he couldn't get out of, his brother, the Mountain. And he noticed that, like, what she's looking at and what she's thinking. He goes to prevent her. What I thought is interesting that they make it a point that everyone leaves her to stand on that catwalk, so... Like, is the Hound the greatest suicide hotline operator ever? Like, he just needs to say two sentences to you, and you're like, you're right, I've completely reconsidered my thoughts. And
yeah,
you can be trusted with a bottle of Tylenol, a razor blade, a loaded shotgun, a length of braided rope, like all that stuff. You can just, there's suicide's the furthest thought on your mind after he talks to you.
Yeah, he's got the silver tongue, that Hound. I do think there are two things going through Sansa's head. One is, I could jump off here and kill myself because things are so bad. I could also shove Joffrey off.
Oh, you were thinking she was going
him.
To shoving Joffrey.
I think so, yeah. Hmm. I mean, I think both of those things are going through her head, and she chooses to try to go after Joffrey because she walks up to him, but then the Hound stops her, and then, you know, she could also take her own life here.
I thought that after largely showing Sansa being a silly person this season, that the last few episodes where she, gave a pretty good defense of her father and negotiated a fairly tricky thing with, of course, the king welched on the agreement.
Right.
And this is kind of her, she's, what I'm trying to get at is she's showing a surprising amount of underlying strength. You know, she kind of Sansa's out in the first few moments of the scene, but then she finds the steel to look at her father and a septon and kind of like show Joffrey that he has no power over her.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he can have his knights bully her, but, you know, kind of like you can't imprison my mind or my spirit.
That's the other thing about it here is she does have a little bit of power, right? I mean, Joffrey obviously can't do absolutely anything he wants because his mother wants him to marry this girl,
which is strange. We're going to talk about in the feedback about, like, what is the political ramifications of him marrying Sansa at this point.
Okay. Regardless, I think there are parental ramifications,
right?
He's still got to listen to his mom a little bit.
Yeah.
So Sansa is, I don't want to say safe here. I think she's still in danger.
She somehow
but
knows that he can't. Like,
there
this
are
is
some
the worst.
Limits.
Yeah, right. He can torment you by, you know, taunting her with his cruelty to others, and he can rough you up with his Kingsguardmen, but he can't. Yeah, he can't mortally hurt her at this point.
Right.
But
really making Joffrey out to be just a shit here. I mean,
yeah, oh yeah.
He just loves to torment people.
Yeah. And he thinks this is strength. He thinks these things, bullying a little girl.
He thinks people are going to respect or fear him.
Fear, yeah. I think he's going with the fear is better than being liked and respected.
Yeah.
But
he might even be confusing the two. I'm not sure. He's still a child.
Many despots do.
Right.
What do you think the Hound thinks of Sir Marin Trant slapping Sansa at... I mean, what... I thought it'd be interesting if the Hound was ordered to slap Sansa, what he would have done.
Huh, okay. I don't know. He certainly seemed to jump in and try and help her as much as he could here.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. It's not great advice, right. You know, just give him what he wants.
And he's a Kingsguard, officially. It's, like, weird to see the Hound... after he's had this ferocious dog mask and this kind of utilitarian plate that being this ornamental, you know, white enameled armor. But yeah, he's a king, so he's got to listen to the king at this point.
Yeah.
I don't think he wants to slap Sans. I don't think he thinks much of this bullshit. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's thought much of Joffrey at all, actually. If you go back to the first episodes where he was telling Tyrion, like, hey, you know... I'm not disapproving what you did, but, you know, you're playing a dangerous game here, and Tyrion doesn't give a fuck, but...
So the men argue about who should be king up in, I guess, they're not in Winterfell here. Where are they?
They would be north of the Twins, so they're kind of in the western part of Westeros' neck. They did, yeah, they're on the other side.
Okay, so they're south of...
kind of like on the border of the Westerlands, maybe. Like that's Tywin's, the Lannisters' kind of like territory.
Huh. Okay. So they've taken a castle here, or a small keep, whatever it is. Because they're in some
hall. In the Riverlands. So I also think that they talked a mess about. I mean, I don't know exactly where they're supposed to be, but they also talked about how what they did last week freed up the. River Run, which is where, you know, Kat's father, and they've got a lot of loyal bannermen. So I think this is still friendly territory. They might not have had to invade to keep, but
gotcha.
Maybe this is supposed to be River Run?
Maybe.
I don't know.
But they're arguing about who should be king. Rob thinks it should be Stannis because he's next in line.
Sure.
He's got his dad's opinion of the whole thing.
Yep.
Some of the other men think it should be Renly, but Greyjoy Umber doesn't give a shit who's the king in the south. He wants the north to rule itself. And he proclaims Rob the king in the north.
Yeah. And this makes good sense because he says, like, we bowed to the dragons. Mm. There are no more dragons anymore. So why, you know, and we had a long and illustrious history of ruling ourselves. Why shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
A logical conclusion to this is that now that Ned's dead, I guess he's still got the sisters to quest for, but... might be the smartest thing to just go ahead and just hold the north. Declare yourself as king of the north, sit up north, and see what happens.
Yeah. Could be.
Hold on to Jaime, ransom your sisters for Jaime, and then let Tywin brave the neck and everything else that he'd have to get through to get up to the north to punish you for it.
Yeah. And I know they're unaware of this, but maybe hope that whatever Varys' plan is causes enough chaos for them to ignore the North for a while.
Right. Well, I mean, that's sometimes, like, in strategy, like, not taking an action is better than taking an ill-conceived or hasty action. Because you never know what's going to, you know, time and unforeseen occurrences befall us all.
It's true.
Even great men like Tywin Lannister. So the
king could get gored by a boar.
Sure. Boar gores is the worst.
So Catelyn goes to see Jaime. And she bashes him with a rock, and Jaime makes it clear, I'm not afraid of death. But Catelyn asks how Bran fell out of the tower. Jaime says, I pushed him because I wanted him dead, but doesn't really tell her why. And she kind of lets it go. You really, Catelyn? You're not going to press this issue? I guess she didn't think she could get an answer out of him?
That's the thing, because I was having the same thoughts, and I was analyzing the scene, and I feel like that Jaime is trying to impress upon her, like, what answer do you want that would satisfy you? Like, you already know enough to kind of say, like, why, you know, it's almost like he was giving her a level of respect, like, you're smart enough to have figured this, you got all the information you need to figure it out, so you know, if I what is me saying it going to do? And she kind of realized that, like, does she really want to hear him say that? Like, I don't know, that's my two-bit analysis of what emotions they're feeling here.
Okay. It was pretty impenetrable for me. I don't know how I feel about this scene. Do you buy that Jamie's not afraid to die, though? Or is he putting on a face here?
Dude, that's a really good question. I don't know.
I think I bought it. I think
Because you got to remember that this is after he was entrusted by his very difficult to please, notoriously hard to please father. He was entrusted with half the army to distinguish himself. Mm-hmm. And he's now sitting in his foe's prison camp, covered in mud and shit and slapped around by Cat Stark.
Yeah,
I would think that in this moment, maybe he's like, I would rather die than be raped. Can you imagine what Jaime would think about being ransomed back to his father's side under these circumstances?
Yeah, he'd never live it down.
Yeah, like, I've tried several different types of living in my life, and none of them have been particularly successful. So he needs to talk to the Hound. He needs to talk to the Hound because he's feeling suicidal.
Yep. Lancel is nude in Cersei's chamber. Bow chicka wow.
Uh-huh.
She's reading a letter.
Really downshifted from Jaime.
Lancel has a tiny baby bird body. Like,
Lancel looks like, you know how, like Barbie has, like, Skipper, her little, and she's, like, the slighter, girlish version. And, like, I assume that Ken must have, you know, Jeffro or some. It's like, I feel like he's the
a more fragile frame.
Yeah, he's the prepubescent version of a Ken doll.
He's a Tim Burton character in this scene.
like the
long skinny limbs.
So if you put a black wig and strap some scissors to him, and he's Johnny Depp and Edward Scissorhands, is that what you're saying?
Except skinnier, except thinner and frailer looking, and just like,
he looks like a lesser member of the Twilight cast.
Yes.
Like the one you only find out about third movie when it's dramatically appropriate to understand some bullshit vampire plot.
The one who turns into a bird. Because
that's his vampiric Christ. Gift.
He really just looks like a kid here.
Yeah,
it's
no.
A little creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know how old he's supposed to be in this show, but not old enough, Cersei.
Yeah.
I can tell you that.
Yeah. And Cersei clearly has no use for him other than warming her bed.
Right. She doesn't want to talk to him about this letter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What does the letter say?
I think it's that Jaime has been captured, yeah? Because this is kind of like after we see, you know, they're talking about, oh, it's going to be war, and it's going to be, so we go right to Tywin's council. Seems like they're all finding out about this. We're supposed to understand all at the same time.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I mean, are there any implications here of her sleeping with Lancel? We know that Lancel's, what, a cousin?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess it would be one thing if she took Lancel to bed after finding out that Jaime was a prisoner of war and he's not coming back anytime soon. That's still kind of, you know, ooh, gross. Mm-hmm. But the fact that Jaime's just roding off to war, this is supposedly the love of her life, and now she's like, I think I'm going to fuck his cousin. That's,
yeah, it's
that
kind
says,
of a one-sided thing here.
And I know they've tried to add a lot of dimension to Cersei successfully, but it fundamentally tells you the difference between what Jaime, you know, we've seen Jaime willing to murder a child to protect the woman he loves and, you know, the fact that she kind of means everything to him. And we already, I think this is a way to kind of suggest that that might be a little bit of a one-sided affair.
Yeah, could be right. Here's the other thing it does, I think. It kind of firms up this idea that Lancel might have been involved in the death of Robert. We talked about the wine and how
because
maybe he gave him too much.
What coin could Cersei pay a young man with? I mean, gold dragon, sure, but he's already a Lannister, so what?
Sure.
Yeah, but you know, I guess you want to fuck your hot cousin, queen cousin, maybe?
This is Game of Thrones, I guess,
man.
You do,
yeah.
But I don't know. To me, like, their relationship, you know, being a little more intimate, kind of says he had something to do with
that.
I think you're right.
All those things.
All right, we move on to Tywin's advisors talking about the bleak situation with the war. They're considering suing for peace, but Tyrion realizes that's a terrible idea. Smashes a cup on the ground, says, there's your peace.
Mm-hmm.
Says, peace, no peace, as he's pressed against a window.
pressed against a wine glass.
Yeah. Tywin gets angry and sends everyone but Tyrion out of the room. He then compliments Tyrion's strategic thinking and sends him to King's Landing to be Hand of the King. He also, in this scene, calls him my son, which kind of surprised me, because I thought they had a pretty antagonistic relationship.
Well, it's also, you know, it echoes back to his conversation with Jaime. Like, when he says, you're my son, does he mean, like, even even the lowest of my sons is still better than putting my brother, who might maybe have some, you know, some pretensions, some delusions of grandeur, it's to this elevated position. So like you being my son ruling as a hand adds prestige to my family, whereas putting Kevin as hand of throne would almost reflect our glory onto him, and I don't want any of that.
Right.
So I thought it was a pretty... I don't think Tyrion realizes this because he's so fucking excited, but this feels like a very political decision. This is not a sudden... Although, I don't know. Like, is Tywin really seeing Tyrion in a new light here?
Or is he just saying it? Is he just seizing upon this opportunity where Tyrion has kind of shown some intelligence?
Yeah, and Joffrey is completely, you know... And, like, to what extent does Tywin know, like, how... I mean, you gotta think that Tywin knows about Tyrion's penchant for slapping around Joff. And for being antagonist. So he's like also thinking, like, if I wanted to, the perfect person to keep these people in line until I can fucking put down this rebellion and get back and sit on the throne myself, maybe it's Tyrion. And maybe he is seeing him in a different light for the first time. Like, hey, he, you know, was clever enough to rescue his own damn self. Jaime can't do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit of probably all. It's his, you know... calculations of how this looks politically and a newfound respect for his drunken whoring son, and also a test too, because he says, hey, all this can be yours, lay off the wine, because he grabs the wine from him, and also don't take that whore to court.
He orders him not to do that. So there's one interesting thing I wanted to bring up here is the change in relationship between Joffrey and Tyrion. Like, maybe Tywin is counting on Tyrion kind of putting Joffrey in his place and keeping him under wraps here, but, like, he's the king now. Mm-hmm. Like, before, he was the king's son. He could take a slap or two and not be able to do anything about it, whereas now he could have Tyrion's head if he wants it.
Well, not only that, but, like, the Kingsguard are sworn to protect the king from just such a physical offense.
Right.
Like, if the Kingsguard are going to let Tyrion run around slapping people, then that's, like, regardless of what Joff says, like, you...
Who do you think they're more afraid of? Joffrey? Like, if Tyrion goes to slap Joffrey, do they stop him and chop his hands off or something? Or are they so afraid of Tywin and his wrath that they maybe let it happen?
Well, I mean, that goes back to how degraded this particular version of the Kingsguard is, because, like, Kingsguard back in the Mad King's day wouldn't give a shit about Tywin. Yeah. Like, you go to try to slap the king, we're going to kill you. We are fucking going to kill you, and that's all there is to it. These guys, they slap 13-year-old girls.
That's true.
I think they might be afraid of Tywin.
Okay.
But... that's the. I mean, there's a reason that I didn't really care about reading the books one way or another. I ended up reading at least the first two in between seasons one and two because I couldn't wait to see how that dynamic played out. Like, I am not going to wait to see a whole fucking year to see what happens when Tyrion comes to King's Landing, because you're right.
It's easily the most exciting part.
You expect him just to be pimp slapping left and right, but he's pimp slapping a king. How's that going to work?
Things have changed.
Watch on. That's all I got to say.
The rest of them are headed up to Harrenhal to regroup.
Right.
That's where Tywin's going to kind of base himself. I guess they're sending the mountain to set the Riverlands on fire as well, which he seems to be pretty good at.
He's already kind of raping and reaving around there. That's why Ned dispatched the men out to bring him to justice. He's just essentially doubling down on that strategy.
Yeah. So Dany wakes up in the tent that she went into. She was taken into last episode.
Yep.
She wants to know where her son is. Jorah tells her the son was a hideous monster and it died during birth. It had dragon scales and fangs and red eyes. I don't know what it had, but it sounded
disgusting.
Blind,
leathery wings, is full of grave worms. Yeah.
Ugh. And Dany wants to see Drogo, so she goes outside to see that her Khalasar has abandoned her entirely, almost entirely. There are some slaves left and one or two blood riders of Drogo's blood riders, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or were they blood riders? I don't know. The one guy with the shorter hair.
Yeah, no, they were more. They were not Khal Drogo's blood riders. They were kind of like the people who were close to Dany.
Okay. So Dany finds Drogo in the sun. He's alive but not responsive, and the witch uses some flowery language here, some poetry to say he's never going to be like he was and that she did all of this on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Danny's mad because she thinks...
Is it poetry language or is it a prophecy, Jim?
I don't know. How do you tell the difference? How do you ever tell the difference until
it
comes
true? Well,
when
one's a witch that's cackling in the background, maybe it can be more prophetic than, you know, fucking hot pie in Gin Alley talking. But...
Right.
Yeah, I'm kind of, you know, that's always a fun thing to play. Is this a throwaway sentence, a prophecy, or is this person essentially saying, like, in modern days, if 1,000 years from the future, when Germ the 23rd writes some epic thing about 20th century America, and some character says, ha, that'll happen when pigs fly, there will be in the Reddit of the future people saying, oh, well, you know, there's a pig in chapter 43 of the Chronicles of the American Empire. I just wait for it to sprout wings and fly. Like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know how much to read into it here. Maybe what's happening is the polarity of the planet is realigning here. The magnetic poles are switching, and the Earth's gonna whatever planet this is gonna turn the other way, and the sun's gonna set in
the
west.
You need to flip more than magnetic poles. You need to flip the actual poles, man.
Well, that would happen automatically.
A planet the size of Venus will smack into Westeros and. flip it up on its ass. I don't know. Then the stallion will mount the world.
Right.
Boom. So we talked a little bit about this in the spoiler section about where do you stand on the Miri Mazdur situation? Did she architect this whole thing? You
like,
don't care?
All of this shit, I do not care about.
Okay.
None, zero of it.
Why?
But I'll follow you down
dead,
this.
Just because she's dead at the end of the episode, so it is completely irrelevant?
No, it's magical bullshit. I don't care about any of
it,
man.
No, I'm not talking about the magic. I'm talking about when Danny pulled her out of the streets from being raped 3 times already, we found out in this episode, did she decide, I'm going to use my medicine to kill this Cal and his unborn child? And
I don't think it happened then, but I do think she seized upon an opportunity.
That's
when she was called upon to heal him to take some revenge.
Right. Okay.
Well, I think she did it on purpose.
And I don't even know. I kind of feel, I don't know. I guess it's, I think it is more like she's an opportunistic killer in the sense that she was trying to do the right thing up until... you know, Danny asked her to essentially raise the dead, and then she's like, okay, all right, that's what you want, knowing what the price would be paid and all that.
Yeah.
So, and even then, like, she still told Danny to stay the fuck out of the tent, and Jorah drug her back in there, and she's trying to, you know, do necromancy in the one hand and deliver a child of the other.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't, I don't know, I feel like Danny got ripped off here.
Oh, yeah.
Life for death or whatever whatever that line was. I thought it was the horse, too, Danny. I'm with you.
No, this like, is all very monkey paws shit. But, you know, there you go, Danny. Like, this is why you never trust a genie or a monkey's paw or any of that stuff, because they're always going to fuck you.
Yeah.
Or a real estate agent or any, like, they're always going they're always going to fuck you, man.
I like the...
Used car salesman,
mundane jobs with genies and witches.
Yeah, well, you just can't, you know. They're making statements. There's no fiduciary responsibility there.
Merlin, the used car salesman, when he tries to sell you that Dodge Dart, don't go for it.
Just you know, grab the sword out of the lake, and everything will be fine. that's all you got to do.
Oh man, I watched a behind the scenes documentary here, but. They were talking about Jason Momoa and his acting in this scene. They said he's not acting, actually. This is just what the state he went into when he realized he was off Game of Thrones.
Ah, bummer. I was thinking that, like, I was going to try to make a joke earlier when you said you were so bored of the Khal Drogo plot line. I'm like, well, so was Khal Drogo. He just died of boredom.
Just stared off into the middle
distance.
Doesn't
have a Khalasar anymore? I mean...
Yeah.
The Dothraki, they might be flexible on the whole, you know, Cal that can't ride is no Cal at all, but the Cal that cannot even sip from a sippy cup is definitely no Cal, and they've all fucked off, so.
Who the hell drug him out there to that bluff?
Oh, probably the fine strapping young Dothraki that stayed with Danny, like Jorah.
That'd still be an effort.
Yeah,
He's a big dude.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Jason Momoa's got...
But I think you and I could, like, carry Jason Momoa if we were asked to. Did you just call him Jason Momoa?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been randomly calling him that.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you heard me pronounce it that way and got things wrong.
Maybe he's just, he's got sunstroke and he can't move.
Plus, he could just be in a fucking coma.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I don't think that's how modern people would see a coma patient. Is like, hey, can you, are you still in there? Nope. Okay,
nope,
here comes the pillow.
Him. Yeah.
But whatever. She needed to burn a body.
So John takes a horse and he leaves Castle Black over Sam's protests. He just literally over Sam's dead body.
I do want to say, because we're making a lot of fun here, but I do think this is a pivotal moment in Game of Thrones, this whole what is life worth when all the red... This is a theme that Ned Stark threw out last episode of, like, do you think that I value my life so highly that I'd give up my honor and all that? Like, I think Khal Drogo would say the same thing if you asked him, like, hey, you know, you're going to give up all the things that you value in life, but you'll still be technically alive. He'd be like, this is hell.
Yeah.
And I think this is something, it's also a formative experience for Dany, because Dany thought she did a good thing. Like, she got all, you know, like, I'm going to keep people from being raped and all this. She couldn't even keep the person that she couldn't even save the people that she'd saved.
Right.
You know, like, it was already, like, this is kind of a harsh reality she has to face that, you know, even if you do war perfectly, innocent people are going to die. And cities are going to be overthrown and burnt, and people are going to be put to the sword that shouldn't have been. And I think this is kind of her coming to grips with that, and which makes her burning this witch at the stake a little bit more darker on second, third watch, I think.
Okay.
Because, you know, from Dany's perspective, this is a person who is wronged by Khal Drogo. What would Dany do in Miri Mazdur's position?
If she were raped and taken as a slave?
Yeah.
And given the opportunity to strike back?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Essentially, she was, right? House was destroyed and... you know, not literally, but like if someone had come and invaded her land and pulled down the temple to the gods that she worshipped and killed all of her family and then raped her, like I think she would do some kind of blood, fire and blood thing. So,
all of that has happened, and they were on their way to come conquer Westeros because of it, right? Like,
so I think it's interesting that Dany's essentially sacrificing a proxy version of herself here,
right? Yeah, I wonder.
With no small amount of malice, too. Like, I think she says, like, I don't need your screams, just your death, which is, I think, mechanicalistically true, but I think she likes the screams.
Yeah, she's all right with the screams. No problem. So John takes his horse and leaves Castle Black over Sam's protests. He's going to join up with Rob. I like how Ghost sprints off after him here. Think he can keep up with a horse? Feel like a horse could outrun a dog any day of the week.
Yeah, it's like the whole, I don't know. It depends on the distance, and I don't know who's got the deal. Because I know a human can beat a horse in a marathon, but not a sprint.
Right. Yeah, same with like a deer or whatever, right? Like an injured deer, that's how people hunt sometimes.
Right. You can just run them down to exhaustion because we can sweat and they can't.
Right. All they can do is pant.
Yeah, so I said, so I don't know, like a dog, like I know horses sweat and dogs pant, so could a horse outrun a dog in short distance, long distances? I don't know
either, but that's what happens. Then we go over to Shay, who's mad at Tyrion for not taking her to King's Landing, and in the end, you know, they talk about it for a second. In the end, he invites her to King's Landing despite his father's orders. I don't understand this.
I think this
is a silly decision by Tyrion. I know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
I think it's just his weakness when people show him any kind of affection whatsoever. Yeah. And it just so happens that the only people showing him affection are whores.
And sell swords.
And sell, sure, yeah.
People that are taking his money in return for protection and affection.
And like, he mistakes that for genuine affection.
It's hard to defend. It is
super
It's his, it seems like it's a big character weakness of his.
Right. Completely understandable. I mean, he's starved for affection, right? Nobody likes him.
Yeah.
So I get it. At the same time, I just hate to see him make this decision.
No, it's not something you feel good. Like, you want your heroes to be perfect, and they're not.
Yeah.
But this seems particular. I agree. A galling, like, God damn, this is such a bad idea. Like, you spent this whole season talking about what a hard ass and smart, well-informed person your father is, and you're going to do the one thing that he told you expressly not to do just because this woman that you've met for like less than a week got all pouty on you when you said you no longer needed her services, when he spelled out the terms of the contract. Like,
I guess I just didn't quite feel the connection that he thought was there.
Yeah.
From Shay. They didn't have enough screen time. They had that one scene where really it all felt one-sided from Tyrion revealing himself.
Right.
Not so much like Shay revealing herself or anything like that. So I don't really know why there's such attachment here other than he just has a weakness for anyone who shows him affection whatsoever. And obviously it's a repeat, an exact repeat of his previous marriage, right? This story he told last episode.
Yeah. I think you're right on, and it is disappointing, but I think it's a human, it's nice that he has this kind of big flaw that we can all see, because otherwise, like, Tyrion would almost be a Mary Sue level character.
Right.
He's the smartest.
Too perfect.
Like his big flaw is that he's a dwarf.
Yeah.
He's that short. Still happens to, you know, out drink, out pussy and think everybody else in the room. So that's the classic Mary Sue type of stuff.
Right. So John rides away from Castle Black while several men on horses pursue him. One of them is clotheslined on a tree branch. And he falls off his horse and John hears them screaming
Sam's
name.
When you say one of them, it's Sam. It has to be Sam.
Right. Sam's... But I think we're meant to think that John is running from the guards of Castle Black who are trying to bring him back.
Up until that point. Yeah.
Up until they start shouting, Sam, are you all right? That sort of stuff. And John hears it. He stops. And then his friends surround him and start chanting his oath in his face until he relents and says, fine, fine, fine. I'll come back. Jesus,
this
guys.
Is the shit that works on a Stark, man. Just reciting the vows that he's already taken are enough to, return him to his place.
I think it's really the sword that convinces him. When they hand him that sword and he looks at it after, you know, them spouting the oath at him over and over.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the responsibility and the trust that Gior has placed in him is what brings him back ultimately. And also his friends.
That's why I thought that what Gior says later about honor made you leave and honor brought you back. Also, I didn't say it was your honor, was so perfect. Like, I don't think there's any more that needs to be said than that three-part coda on honor, because it's exactly true.
Yeah.
All of those things, like all the type of person that John is and everything about him, which is also encompasses the ability to be a leader and that he's bound very tightly with his class of brothers. All those things are what causes this to happen and what makes it almost inevitable that he'd be brought back.
Yeah. It's a pretty good scene.
Yep.
Anyway, Danny...
It's corny, but the fact that it still moves me, it shows that it's effective despite the fact that, you're right, it's just three guys... or three or four guys shout. It's almost like a children's afternoon show, like they're going to form Captain Planet here.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's pretty silly.
They just
the
need
flat.
They need some flashy rings, and there you go.
Can you imagine having that happen in real life to you? Like... You're just going to do something foolish and your friends get around you and start chanting like, oh, you made this promise, Aaron.
you
made this promise.
I know you had a different experience, but trying to slowly leave a cult that's kind of... I had a lot of people cornering me and like, but what of your vows and what of your, you know?
Yeah, no.
Yep.
They didn't have a sword to give you.
No, see, if I had a sweet-ass Valyrian sword...
You need a totem to keep you in the... organization.
Yeah, might still be Jehovah's Witness, but there's no swords. Despite what you've read on the internet, there's no Valyrian swords involved.
Nope.
Don't let them come to your door and tell you otherwise. There will be no sword.
So Dany is washing Drogo. She pleads with him to come back to reality, and he doesn't respond, so she smothers him with a pillow. Just instantly, boom. Fine. Yep. You're not going to talk to me? Take this.
Yep. I mean, I feel like that we're supposed to understand that this is a torturous decision that she probably,
we're making
they stayed
fun of
in this fucking desert for one more day, that everyone would die for Khalasar, and that's the... But it also happens in the span of 15 minutes, so it's kind of funny.
Yeah, and I like to describe these scenes a little tongue-in-cheek.
Sure.
So, you know, take it with a dose of, this is still really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But another... kind of cool scene here that I like, the old switcheroo. Pycelle's in his chambers talking about all the kings he served and, you know, telling stories about them as Roz the whore, who we saw, you know, is Littlefinger's employee, puts her clothes back on, and he forgets to finish his initial thought about, you know, the thing you need to remember about kings.
Right.
And Roz is like, fuck this, I'm out. She leaves, and then Pycelle gets up and does some stretches, and he's bouncing around, and he gets dressed, and then he heads to the door, and before he leaves, he purposely hunches back over.
Mm-hmm.
Roz's
vagina has fabulous healing powers, but very short duration.
Right. and they're delayed in their effect, too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting. It adds... Because we've been conditioned to think of Pycelle as the bumbling old fool who's lived past
right.
his prime.
Yeah.
And yet... And Littlefinger and Varys are the real power, but I think they're here hinting that there's wheels within wheels, man. Like, he's playing yeah. his little game, and maybe he's playing it better than anyone.
Yeah, to what end? Like, why is it valuable for people to think you are more frail than you actually are?
Why is it valuable for people to underestimate you? And physically,
though. Although I guess he's doing the mental
underestimation
here. That's
what I'm saying. Like, he's...
I don't think he actually forgot what he was trying to say. This was all a ruse.
No. I think he's, you know, trying to maybe dip payment to the whore, if anything. But, you know, Grandpa forgot his wallet and his other robes. I don't know. I think it's... I mean, I don't know... So everyone says, like, oh, they're going to underestimate you, and, like, that's such a huge... I've never quite understood that. Like, I understand when people
It's an advantage, certainly.
I suppose.
It's creating an artificial advantage, actually. One that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Right, but it seems like it works best when there's actually military knowledge that you can manipulate. It's not like, you know, I'm going to go fight a 8-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm properly, if he would say to his friends in the schoolyard, and again, I don't know why I'd be beating up this 8-year-old, but let's assume he really had it coming.
He did.
And I'm
yeah.
entirely morally justifiable, not a jury would convict me, okay, just to stave off all uh-huh. the emails. But, like, if he was to talk amongst his friends, like, well, the key I have against Aaron is he's underestimating. No, I'm properly estimating you, you little shit. Which is one of the many reasons I'm going to beat you up now.
What if it turned out he was, like... a 13-year-old. You thought he was an 8-year-old, but he's actually 13.
Or he's a fucking dwarf
he's
from
got
Lord
a
of the Rings,
body.
And he's going to whip out too bad. Like, yes, then I could have underestimated him. But, that seems like something that the Davids like to tell themselves when they're against the Goliaths. And 9 times out of 10, they get steamrolled.
Here's a question I have, which I think is equally as interesting. Roz is an employee of Littlefinger.
Sure.
So Littlefinger obviously knows that Pycelle is whoring around, right?
Right.
I don't know if maesters are supposed to be able to do that with their oaths or whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems like using Littlefinger's whores seems like a bad idea if you are on the small council with a man as tricky as Littlefinger.
Well, but on the other hand, he keeps his illusion up. Maybe he know. I mean, that's the thing. Does he know? Like, I would think that
he might want that word to get back to Littlefinger.
That's what
actually.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, I'm wondering if he's using this to. It's like, oh, it's like if you, what's a clear advantage if you know your enemy has your headquarters mic'd. Mm-hmm. That's a huge advantage if you know about it before he knows you know. So this could be an example of he is again sowing the seeds of him being decrepit and. Useless and powerless. Like I'm not fully understanding what exactly this does other than, people treat like the same reason why Varys uses children. People don't think about street urchins. What's-his-face right. made that point with Arya this episode. It's like nobody gives a shit about some base-born child running around the streets. Mm-hmm. So Varys using them as spies. People also don't take in this universe seriously women or the elderly. So I guess if you really play up the fact that you're a befuddled old fool, people might slip and say things and be unguarded in a way that they would if around the Littlefinger or Varys.
Okay.
So, I guess intensifying that act for his whore so they'll report back, oh, yeah, this guy's decrepit, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's a randy old man, that's all, would be useful, but it's not immediately obvious to me why.
Yeah, I just think I wouldn't be using... Littlefinger services. Like, what if he wants to kill you? The sending in one of his hordes is the perfect opportunity. Well, I mean, that's a question, is like,
what if you wanted to get your rocks off, but you knew that every whore in King's Landing is going to be under Littlefinger's employ?
Right.
Or, if not, that he would know about, he's involved enough to know who got sent, and they could probably buy you off and get the information from you. Like, I think that's just a reality. Like, yeah. All whores in King's Landing are owned by Littlefinger.
Seems like it. Anyway, he's looking at the throne, Littlefinger. Varys comes up, and Littlefinger asks him what he would do with the throne. Varys says, I don't want it. They talk about what is or isn't between Varys' legs for a bit, and then proclaim their admiration for each other until Joffrey comes walking in, and they go to their small council meeting.
I love that line of Varys. It's like, do you, at night in your chambers, do you fear my gash?
Yeah, it's so good. Just the way that Littlefinger, or not Littlefinger, Varys redirects all these questions and this insinuation, and just like jabs that Littlefinger is throwing, Varys is redirecting.
It makes Littlefinger look smaller and Varys look more badass.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Because Littlefinger, Varys doesn't get rattled. Like, you are not even the 1,000th person to make fun of the fact I don't got no dick.
Right.
Right? Come on.
Yep. There is a nice little move by Littlefinger here, though, because I feel like at the end, you know, Varys sees the king walk in and he bows, and Littlefinger, Varys says something about the king, and Littlefinger's like, long may he reign, in a very, like, very loud voice that Joffrey is sure to hear.
Sure.
And then he spins around and does his little bow. He just, like, he's on the spot with that flattery of the king.
And you might on the first watch think that Varys is going to catch him and, like, oh, he's behind me, isn't he? But nah, Littlefinger's not going to be caught.
Nope.
No way.
Good stuff. And I don't know that I buy that Varys doesn't want the throne either. Like, is that true? How do you feel about Varys' intentions?
I don't know. Really don't. That is a thing that he has asserted many times this season, and this could be the sweet summer child in me, but I believe him. Like, I really in season one, I really clearly did not like Littlefinger, and didn't help that he fucked over Ned, but I also clearly liked and I respected Varys.
Yeah.
But I don't know his game. I don't know his plan.
I don't either. All right, we go to Yoren explaining to Arya the trouble she's in and advising her on how to pretend to be a boy. Arya bumps into a couple of bigger boys who want her sword. She's ready to defend herself and maybe kill these kids before Gendry comes up and intimidates them. They run away, and then he notices Arya's fancy sword, and Gendry says, I'm going north with you guys because my master got sick of me, and they depart for the wall. Or they depart for the north. I don't know about the wall. Yoren's certainly going to the wall.
I think Gendry's somehow got in this recruiting class, too.
He has, yeah.
Yeah.
He's, I guess, going to the wall just because his master's done with him, and he can't get another job? I don't know exactly why Gendry's going up to the
wall. I don't either, honestly. I feel like that there was... Didn't Ned say something about in some of the last notes he was making, didn't he have something in there about getting... somehow protecting Gendry or getting him out? Or I really don't know. I'm pretty sure I could find the answer, but I didn't even know to look this up. I didn't know that... when I was watching it, It didn't pop up my matches like, oh shit, I don't remember why he's doing this and what machinations are happening to protect him.
Yeah, it might be just that, like, this is a move to protect Gendry, because we know that
that's what I'm saying, it's like, I don't remember who, or if that's even a thing, or if...
Well, it might be, so, okay, if I'm his master, right, there have now been two people... Snoop poking their heads around. Two hands of the king.
Like, I don't need this.
Poking their heads around, who have both died.
I don't need this kind of heat. Yeah.
Yeah. Get the fuck out of here, man.
But
go to the wall.
He's an apprentice, not a slave. So I almost think that maybe Gendry is like, well, shit. I am a orphan I'm a bastard of Flea Bottom. Mm-hmm. My master is no longer taking me on as an apprentice. Wants nothing to do with me. So I guess I'll just take the black. Why not? Maybe, and that's the thing, like the wall's reputation down south is not even what it is up north, I'm sure there's an answer. I don't have it. I apologize.
He's taking his bull helmet with him, though.
He is taking his bull helmet.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I'm thinking
it's like the only thing he took.
I'm thinking that this I was thinking, like, what is the significance of this? Because, you know, we know that he's a Baratheon, which is a stag, And, like, you know, we've seen dogs and wolves and all this other stuff. Like, are they trying to tell us something with this bull?
I have no idea. It looks cool, though.
It does look fucking cool as hell. I'd like to see him actually wear it.
Yeah. I don't think Arya needed his help here, honestly. Nah. I think she carves these two kids up like...
That's why I thought it was super awesome, because Arya had already backed them up, and then he backed right into Gendry, who's like, you know, I thought that's such a great line. It's like, I hammer steel all day, and it sings. Are you going to sing when I hit you? Like,
yeah, that's real good.
That's the thing, like, there's a couple people you don't want to fuck with. Blacksmiths.
Yeah.
Blacksmiths are definitely in the school of, like, I don't care if you look like a fat tub of shit, I am not going to fuck with you. Because you do. You bang steel all day, and that has to make you hard.
Yeah, for sure. Gior, another guy I probably wouldn't want to fuck with, reveals that he knows Jon left last night, and he says, it's no big deal, because honor brought you back. Talks about the possible uniting of the factions north of the wall and the monsters that are up there, and he tells Jon, we're going north to figure out what the hell's happening up there and to take on the wildlings, the White Walkers, and whatever else is out there. And Jon goes with him.
Yeah. Are you a brother of the Night's Watch or a bastard boy who wants to play at war?
Yeah.
With all due respect, sir, that's a false dichotomy, a classic logical fallacy, and my life can't be reduced to these two options.
Right.
Jor says, what the fuck?
He says all that with his mouth hanging open? I don't think so. Come on.
He can't bring his teeth together. He's going to have a hard time making teas. What? So, I actually thought this... Again, I'm super impressed with Jor, because...
Yeah.
He kind of lets him off the hook, but then he puts it right back on him after he lays out the stakes and says, do you think your war is any more important? Do you think your brother's war is more important than ours? And, like, I think if at the end, Jon feels both built up, but also, like, properly put back in his place. Yeah. Like, you should feel an appropriate amount of shame and stupidity, but also kind of inspiration, because this great man is going to forgive you and overlook it and still see your potential.
Yeah.
So, good job, Jor.
Yeah, I also like his line about when he's talking about Ned. He's like, what, you're going to bring him back to life? I've had enough of that.
Right.
He's talking about the whites that tried to kill him just last episode. Pretty good.
No, good line. It's great. Like, sometimes the writing, and a lot of it's lifted, of course, from the books, but it really does, for all this the shit it gets about the sex position, sometimes it just really crackles.
Yeah. Anything else in that scene, or should
we
get on? Okay, Drogo's body, the witch, and Dany's dragon eggs are all burned on a pyre. Or they're all, you know, hanging out there. And Jorah's pleading with her not to sacrifice herself, because he knows she wants to walk in. She just can't get enough of this. So it might be a little cold out. You know, it gets cold at night in the deserts.
Sure.
She's real interested in getting in on this fire thing. She frees the slaves who stayed and invites them to follow her and promises they'll hear their enemies' death screams. Then she lights the fire and listens to the witch scream for a bit before strolling right into the flames.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next day, Jorah finds Dany alive in the ashes, cradling her hatch dragons.
So, addition to her other crimes, the witch, we also have to, we can blame her for inventing screamo.
What? There was music playing, I'm sure.
Well, she was singing. It started off that way.
Oh, she was. You're right.
Like,
chanting,
it was a musical fusion here. So, this is an epic moment. This very slight naked woman cradling all these dragons is epic. And as epic as the Rangers riding in force.
Dany's no Lancel. I think Dany's got some
That's true.
Heft to her, which I like, because it makes her feel more powerful.
She definitely looks like you know, even though she's short and unassuming, she does have a little bit of that, like, gymnast kind of personal power to her.
Yeah, and it translates not only in, you know, her physical form, but in how she projects herself.
I think, was interesting about the use of nudity with this character, and why I think that Emil Clarke always, like, you know, there was some, I know that people made, I don't want to talk about spoilers. She continues to get naked, is what I'm trying to get at.
But in this moment, it feels very different.
Well, you can compare and contrast it to the first time that her brother made her disrobe and get into the hot water.
Right.
And she was just, you know, almost like a cow being led to a slaughter. She just bovine, and her eyes were, you know, unfocused, and she just has this kind of idiot look of worry on her face, to this, where she's powerful and she knows she's powerful.
Right.
And it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about, like, What made her go into this fire? How much does she know here? Does
right.
She...
We're going to discuss that in feedback.
Okay. That sounds good.
Why but even... That's the thing. Like, I remember the scene and like how epic it was, and the music is swelling, and these dragons, like the pitiful as they are, flexing their wings and screeching. Yep. I didn't remember the other impression I got this time, which is, my God, this Khalasar is pitiful.
Like, oh, yeah.
Both numbers and makeup, and
they're all
like
former slaves, right?
But when it zooms out, you get this long view of the whole, and like just yeah. I mean, you're talking like maybe 200 people, maybe. Ah, it's awesome, but also you see what an uphill struggle she's going to have.
Right.
Like, her mission has not changed. She wants to conquer Westeros. Mm-hmm. Now she's got an old disgraced knight, a couple of young Dothraki boys, three newly hatched dragons, a pile of ash, and about 100 old invalid former slave type people.
Yeah.
Not a great way to build it.
Nope, and that's where we leave season one. I think it's a pretty good end to this season.
Yeah.
Gets us psyched.
Yeah, no, totally. It did its job for making season two seem like it would never get here.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home. Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch. The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed. And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So this is a part of the podcast where we do advertising, and nobody wants to listen to this. This is like Joff parading the severed heads around. Like, you don't wanna look at your dad's head and your Septa's head, but he gonna make you.
Yeah.
We're gonna make you listen to the ads because we need your support, and there's a couple ways you can do that. One is going to club.baldmove.com. You can sign up for low cost, and you get tons and tons of premium features, including ad-free feeds and VIP sections of forums and extra content that we record on a weekly basis just for our club members. Particular interest right now is our first-run movies. We've been doing a lot of them. The spoiler-free reviews are free if you want to hear the spoilers of these movies that we go see. Like, we're seeing Snowden this week. What did we see last week? Sully?
Sully, yeah.
We got some big ones coming up. The Doctor Strange, Star Wars in December. Mm-hmm. If you want our spoiler-filled reviews, you have to be a club member. Also, you can pay the Amazon price, the copper price, by going to amazon.baldmove.com. And that really helps. We derive a surprising amount of our funding through Amazon affiliate links such as that, and all you got to do is remember to go to amazon.baldmove.com. It doesn't cost you anything. You just have to put the bald move between the Amazon and the .com, and we get a teeny tiny cut of whatever's in your cart when you check out, and it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't change any of your shipping, your product availability, nothing. It's just all Amazon with some love for Bald Move preloaded into your cart, and however you choose to support us, we appreciate it because we couldn't do it without you. One other thing I want to mention, because I know we don't have a lot of opportunities to talk before we lose a large portion of the Game of Thrones audience till next year, and the good folks at the Rocket City NerdCon in Huntsville, Alabama, have invited us to be featured guests at their NerdCon, and we would be remiss not to tell you about this party that they are throwing in honor of the nerd. Mm-hmm. If you like Game of Thrones, you like Walking Dead, you like science fiction, fantasy, comic books, you will probably like RocketCityNerdCon.org. It's in the South. I know a lot of times in geek mentions, there's a lot of bemoaning the fact that there's not a lot of cool things that happen down in the South. But here's one of them. Huntsville's a cool city. It's happening October 22nd through 23rd this year. $25 for the weekend pass, $15 per day. Jim and I are going to be down there. We've got several panels that we're hosting and headlining. We got a booth where you can meet our giant Matt Damon face and meet and or greet us. Mm-hmm. You can meet us or you can greet us. You can't do both. If it's a greet, just do the drive-by. If you want to meet us, don't say hi. Just start talking. I think that's how that works.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's meet and greet, not or. Sorry.
Meet, like lunch meets?
No. One of the cool things we're going to do, though, particular note to Game of Thrones fans, is we're going to play a version of, in front of a big audience, we're going to call it volunteers and play a version of like Mafia or Werewolf with a Red Wedding theme, which is going to be super exciting. Me and Jim are going to be in character, and we're going to try to be as funny as possible. We'll see what happens when we try to be funny. A lot of times the podcast, we're accidentally funny. Like, we don't come up with paraplegic brand getting force-fed. what do we do? Beef broth? Not something we actually write. That's just shit that happens organically. Probably when we write it down, it's going to be disaster. Wait, this is supposed to be an effective ad. I'm sorry. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be hilarious. It's going to be well worth your time. Go to Huntsville, Alabama, October 22nd through the 23rd. RocketCityNerdCon.org if you want to get tickets or general information. Follow them on social media. Hope to see you down there.
All right, why don't we get to the feedback?
First up, Cody S. What are the chances that Ned would have followed through and taken the Black and not instead have gone back to Winterfell? And or to Rob's army ASAP and hold up there and wait for Baratheon allies against the king, king inbred.
100% he goes to that wall.
I mean,
he's too honorable not to. He's going to keep his end of the bargain.
Yeah, like some alternate universe evil Ned Stark, in this case, would not have a goatee.
Right.
He'd be clean shaven. Maybe he does something like this, but there's nothing in Ned Stark's character that would say that had his enemies kept their word that he wouldn't have kept his.
Yeah. 100% he goes to that wall.
I think if Kat and Rob and every one of his child rode up to him and said, please, father, please don't take the Black, he'd still be like, well, I said I would, so...
Bye.
Yeah. Like, literally, you're surrounded by leagues and leagues of your loyal bannermen, and they all want you to be king. He'd be like, well, yeah, but I already said I wouldn't, so that's in the story.
I've already forsaken my honor once today.
Yes, yes.
I'm not going to do it again.
Right, right. So I guess that's the counter argument is that, he broke the seal on his honor.
Oh, now all bets are off.
Now it's going to be, that is true. I think that's true. The first transgression is always the hardest.
Oh,
I
agree.
It gets easier. And that's why like a lot of crooks get caught because, you know, what, once you got on after careful thought and deliberation and desperation, you becomes routine and then you get sloppy. And
I would argue maybe this is the second transgression.
Oh,
because I mean, Jon Snow. seems to be a transgression.
Right. The whole,
yes.
Like, don't ask questions about
right.
even to my wife and children, and yeah.
He comes back with this bastard child. I mean, yep. Come on.
Yep. Take it, cat.
There's not
it.
A lot of honor in that.
True. So Jim W. says, I have been wondering about Eddard's final proclamation to the High Septon and Baylor the Blessed that Joffrey is the one true heir to the Iron Throne. Aeron mentioned a podcast and Ned had forsaken his gods in the end. This is kind of like a slightly more nuanced version of the earlier email from Cody. Do you think Ned would have done this on purpose? While his primary reason for his proclamation is to save his daughters, he also thinks he'll live through this confession for a sentence of life on the Wall. He also knows that most people in King's Landing follow the Seven and would accept or even expect a confession made in the name of the new gods. Knowing this, I think he may have made this proclamation under the guise of the Seven rather than his old gods. In doing so, he's not really proclaiming Joffrey as the one true heir. It's his way of telling a lie while effectively crossing his fingers behind his back.
Right.
So, again, does this sound like that Ned Stark we know? That is Ned Stark the kind of guy who would stand up there, give a confession with his fingers crossed?
I don't think so.
That's a little finger move.
Yeah.
Ned has enormous fingers.
It's a fair point, but I don't think that's what's going through his head.
Agreed. Michael W. says, back in 2013, KCRW broadcast and podcast interview with the Double Ds on the treatment hosted by Elvis Mitchell. In this interview, Benioff and Weiss talked about producing the first season and some of the difficulties they faced. One of the problems they had with the show was in regards to the runtime of each episode. Halfway through production, HBO informed them that they were coming up short with some of the episodes, sometimes as much as 20 minutes short, and all they had to come up with 93 more written pages to fill in the gaps, according to HBO, throughout the season. Since they were at this point already out of money in their budget, they had to cut battle scenes and write new scenes with just two people in a room talking. Now, I'm going to post this link because I thought it was fascinating. I'd never heard it before.
Let's go back to the Whisper Willow Woods battle.
Apparently that was going to be a more fully fleshed out thing. Also, they talked in depth about how the scene for Tyrion when he goes into battle was that everyone is going to be like, stay close to the mountain. And they had this whole choreographed thing where Tyrion is staying close to the mountain. And the mountain's this whirling dervish of death. And they just shortened it to him getting hit in the face with a hammer and blacking out. So, and this is where a lot of this sex position, but they said also that one of these pages was the scene between Cersei and King Robert that we really highly valued.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of sex position shit, whatever, but there was a couple of these scenes that were really, really good. And by having to scale back their ambitions and invent these things, they came across some real moments of character truth.
Okay.
So, but no, I thought this is a super interesting interview, and I'll post the link to it in the show notes, and thank you, Michael, for bringing it to my attention. So, I thought that was interesting. I just assumed that they always skip the battles because, battles are not, they're interesting to get your blood pumping, but they actually usually don't move the plot forward as much as the result. Someone won, someone lost, so... Carrie says, I was expecting some conversation in the rewatch about the dismissal of Barristan Selmy by Cersei or Joffrey. It seems that he has the highest respect, honor, and loyalty of the crown of any Kingsguard that they would want to keep him in service. My question is, why dismiss him? Why did they sense the hesitation in him when Cersei ripped up Robert's decree? Ultimately, even if he did have reservations, he followed the king's orders. Did they know that he might not go along with some of the things being planned? Although it was Joffrey, not Cersei, who wanted to kill Ned, so if that's the reason, it seems like it was Joffrey's decision, and Cersei went along with it because they were wanting to surround themselves with more Lannisters and make way for Jaime to be the big cheese. Would this have happened if Tywin or even Tyrion were there? So, wants to delve a little bit into the motivations about why did they dismiss Selmy. Do you have any thoughts? Because I've got like one or two.
I mean, my first thought is, I don't think it's a bad idea. If you know somebody's so honorable that they won't go along with something dishonorable that you want to do, regardless of whether you're
and you're
king
the Lannisters, probably planning fairly a lot of dishonorable things.
Right. I think it's a good idea to get rid of him. I imagine that's where they were coming from.
Yeah. I mean, but on the other hand, this guy served under the Mad King. This is the guy who stood. I don't know if he was in the room. He might have been off with Rhaegar fighting, but he potentially all the things the Mad King did leading up to the deaths of the Stark men that went to go beseech him on behalf of their sister. Like, this guy served through all that.
So maybe they know that he doesn't view Joffrey as the rightful king.
Huh.
Maybe he views Stannis as the rightful king, much like Ned did.
That could,
and if, that he if, would serve the rightful king, not yeah. the king on the throne.
Yeah, that's a good point. My other point is that I think that this is a little bit of just a nepotism.
Sure.
Like, Joffrey yeah. wanted his man, who's been his man since he's been a boy, the Hound, on the Kingsguard.
Yeah.
And that Cersei wanted Jaime because long term, you know, Jaime being the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard is going to let him into her chambers, you know, yeah. pretty much at will.
He doesn't have a tiny bird body.
Yeah, and he doesn't have the tiny bird body. He's got the magnificent Jaime Lannister body.
Right.
And face and hair. Not that I'm attracted to him, no. I've never thought about what his silky embrace would be like. But, yeah, no, I think it was just, like, Cersei wanted Jaime and Joffrey wanted the Hound, so they're just like, how can we make this happen? Bada-bing, bada-boom.
Yeah, it's all mixed up in there. I mean, that's all of the stuff that they mentioned in the email is yeah. exactly, I think, what they're going for.
Yep. Okay. What else? Doug L. says, this week in the podcast, you have discussed the tactical stronghold of the Twins and the high price that Rob has to pay the Freys to use his crossing. I felt the chill run down my spine as soon as this email started because I knew what it was going
to
lead to.
Build a second bridge, goddammit.
You joked it'd be easier to build another bridge to avoid the ill-fated deal that ultimately leads. Well, can't say that because it's a spoiler.
Don't say it would take too much time.
However,
I know that
there is a much easier way, as the, both the book and the show have demonstrated. The easiest route from Winterfall to King's Landing is straight down the King's Road, and many a character takes this path through the, in the story.
Oh, see, I assumed that that was the King's Road, that that was like the only road.
Yeah, it's actually not.
Really?
It's actually not. According to the map in the front of all my books and in the first five maps of Westeros on Google Images, the King's Road goes nowhere near the Twins and indeed involves a completely unnecessary detour off the beaten track to actually get to. Okay, I'm going to confess, Doug, that I don't understand this either. And I've read, I spent, because I remember that bothering me too, because I'm like, what the fuck? If you need to get beat a line to King's Landing, obviously the King's Road is the way. And so there, I'll tell you what the common answers are, and if they're persuasive to you, or if you want to read further, then whatever. But I've just, like, you know, let the matter rest. Number one, the King's Road goes through the Neck, which is this really swampy, marshy terrain. It's notoriously difficult to go through, especially with a large army. So it's imagine, like, you can fit a wagon or maybe a train of wagons through, but 20,000 men, you know, it's one thing to cross in a bridge, but if you had to march for 50 miles single file like that, imagine what a nightmare that would be logistically. And again, swampy, like all those feet turning that shit in the mud. Mm-hmm. The other explanation is that that Rob maybe wanted to veer a little bit west to bring the Westerlands and directly threaten Casterly Rock, or at least make Tywin think that he was planning to do that, so Tywin couldn't just commit his forces to the central part of Westeros and cut off Rob. But honestly, like I mean, I have to trust the tacticians of the A Song of Fire subreddit and the Wiki of Ice and Fire, because that's what they say. But if you just look on a map and you ignore the terrain and what the books say, then it does seem like you could just march right up and not have to worry about crossing the Trident at the Twins.
Okay.
So, yeah. If again, make that of what you will. David T. said, would be interested in hearing your individual takes on how you each chose to ingest what is Game of Thrones canon and what is not, particularly with regard to lore, backstory, and subtext. If I can draw parallels to Star Wars and the shit people love to swallow as canon based on what they read in the expanded universe, Wikipedia, etc.
Tales of the Bounty Hunters.
To me, if something wasn't mentioned or didn't happen on screen, it just didn't happen, as I don't accept some random fan's version of events in the Star Wars universe. The difference, of course, with Thrones is that the TV show watchers, like myself, have the vast amount of bonus material in the Blu-rays to fill in the gaps. Hence, I choose this material as canon as opposed to books, which it...
What?
I know, this is a really convoluted canon strategy he has in his head.
I think so.
From the podcast, I get the feeling that Jim may bias canon the same way I do, kind of ignoring book material altogether. I mean...
No, I use the books to fill in the gaps where the show just doesn't have the information.
Like, right.
I will always, like, if someone comes up to me and says, oh, this is the canon of the Game of Thrones story, right, or the Song of Ice and Fire story,
right,
I will say, you are absolutely right. That is the books. That is the canon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't read those books.
Right.
And so for me, all I can do is go by the TV show, but right, I will always defer to the books.
Okay. I'm actually evolving a little bit more nuanced view of this, is that I think that since the books are plunging ahead, or this, with this unprecedented situation, mm-hmm, of the show plunging ahead of the books, that now you have essentially two versions of canon.
Okay.
And they might mutually contradict.
Two different stories in the same universe?
Yeah. Yeah. It's essentially...
like alternate timeline.
You've got an Old Testament, New Testament situation where... you know, like the Jews and Christians are cool until Jesus shows up, and then it's like, hey, now wait a minute, or yeah, no, this is the, like, I see, like, some of this stuff as being kind of unavoidable because of this kind of never happening before. And, you know, Star Wars, it was easy. Like, they had, like, Lucasfilm themselves had a canon where it's like, the novelist, the movies are canon, and so are the novelization of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything else below that, all the video games and stuff, are canon unless they are directly contradicted by the other material.
Right.
So, to me, you know, that's where you had a whole bunch of, like, well, you know, is Boba Fett dead or alive? Is he the, you know, character from the movies? Is he the character from Tales from the Bounty Hunters? Is he the complex Mandalorian lone wolf honorable warrior that he later became? Like, who the fuck knows? And now that...
and you have the same problem.
J.J. Abrams wadded that stuff and thrown it away and, like, taking, cherry-picking bits and pieces out of it, it's even more complicated. But I honestly think in the future that you're going to have show fans and book fans, and they're going to argue about this stuff all the time because there is a lot of significant changes in characterizations and even events. And
right,
not...
that's where I think you run into the big canon problem.
Right.
Is changing, like, what characters do what and when it happens and all that kind of stuff.
And it was
because
one...
then it's two different stories.
Sure. And
it's
it
not
was...
even just filling in the gaps.
And it's one thing when we had what I used to call, you know, Martin's Razor, where you would have, like, three different characters in the books merged into one.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's like, okay, that's something you can, it's like, you know, you can hold a prism up to and separate it into its constituent parts of the rainbow and say, okay, well,
right,
you know, nothing different happened. It was just that who was the agent that made the action happen. Now, where they're just completely off the page and trying to sort of steer towards an ending that George has hinted at some level of depth, I don't see how they cannot violate things that George is going to later, you know, contradict. And that's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
That's not a decision they made as an adapt, as people that adapted a work. That's just them stumbling in a dark hallway.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do? Like, I'm not aware of this happening to any other kind of series. So
I guess, like, if somebody comes up to me and says, like let's say, okay, you've read all of the books, you've seen all of the show, and this is after it ends. So both of the works are complete. All the books have been written, all the show has been filmed and aired. When someone comes up to you and says, what do you think of this story? What is your tendency? Do you default to the books because that's what Martin wrote? Do you default to the series because that's what was finished first in all likelihood?
That's the thing. Like, I kind of think, so if I'm trying to look into my own soul, I will say that I'll probably consider whichever version I think is superior as the canon.
Okay.
Which I think will probably be the books, and I don't mean superior in, like, a completely objective way. I mean, like, just in the way that I think the books are still slightly better than the show because they're a deeper, richer, if you like the political intrigue, you get more of that in the books. But if the show ends up being more satisfying and more straightforward, I could consider, and especially since it came out first.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, if you got the situation where all else being... everything else being equal, they're kind of the same, then do you give it to the one that came out first? Because that's
well,
that's
I give
the
it to
thing.
The one most closely originated from the author, from the creator of the world, which is why I default to the books, because I think to me that is more representative of the idea of Game of Thrones or A Song of Ice and Fire, because it came from the author and the world builder.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I watched the show first, and then I read the books. So when I was reading the books, I was seeing Sean Bean and, you know, Kit Harington and all these characters, Emilia Clarke, all of them as these characters. Like, just never in a doubt in my mind. And it's interesting because I got later into books and, you know, I didn't supersede it. And then I started having, like, serious opinions of, like, well, this isn't my blah, blah, blah. And I started joining the book readers that were nitpicking the some of the casting. So, like, it's weird because to me, that tells me that I was treating the show as a primary source, even as I was reading the books, until I got to the point where the books superseded and then it became the primary source. So I kind of think in a weird way, I want to see the show as a primary source because it's going to be the first version of the truth.
Right.
So I'll have to have severe problems with that before that's just a guess. Who the hell knows?
Sure.
I want to say that, yeah, I'll always think of the books because that's Martin and it's his story and it's his idea, but shit, man, you had a decade to, you know, finish this thing off and he didn't. So do you abdicate the throne a little bit?
Maybe.
What's the laws of succession? Where's the double D's in?
Does Martin have a brother we can get in
here? It turns out his great-great-grandfather was a buddy of his in the Civil War with the, so who knows? Kaylee. So I was listening to your Episode 9 podcast and your discussion of why Jorah would take Dany into the voodoo tent so the witch, God's wife, could deliver the baby. On the initial watch, this confused me too. However, thinking about it, what if Jorah did this because he didn't want the baby to survive? By this point, his allegiance presumably lies with Dany, and he knows the King Robert has already tried to kill her, so clearly King's Landing sees her as a threat. She would have a much bigger target on her if she didn't have a baby to continue her bloodline, especially a baby boy. King's Landing would definitely want to kill her more if she did have this baby. By taking her into the tent, Jorah had plausible deniability. He didn't actually kill the baby or anything, and can say he didn't know what else to do, but considering the creepy shit going on that tent, with the warning that no one was to enter it as well, he could make a good guess that the baby was not going to survive all that. What do you think of this theory, that Jorah was like, needed to get rid of the baby and the baby mama before, you know?
I have a couple questions. A, do they know Robert's dead?
That is a very fine question that I don't know the answer of. Okay. Probably not at this point.
If they don't know that Robert's dead, I think it lends maybe a little more plausibility to that influencing his decision a little bit.
Right.
If they know that Robert's dead, then there's no reason to fear retribution from Westeros, I think.
Sure.
And I think this is, if that is Jorah's intention, I think it's maybe a foolish move because without the child and without Drogo, Dany doesn't have any power. She doesn't have this army to protect her from any retribution that might come from Westeros, right? Now
she's
all
Jorah.
Alone.
I mean, this is it's no longer a wholesale transaction, it's retail. Like,
she's got Jorah?
Well,
Jorah
mean,
is good
yeah,
as
if,
the
if they flee,
the Kalasar?
If they flee into the Shadowlands, which is essentially beyond the reach of anybody.
Right.
Like, he's just a sellsword protecting a single girl that no one really gives a shit about.
Yeah, until she busts out of dragons and goes, I'm the Khaleesi!
Well, because he didn't know the dragons.
Motherfucker, bow down before me!
Yeah, but you're acting like he knew the dragons were going to be born. That was clearly a shock
to
him.
He's seen Dany's proclivity toward proclaiming how powerful she is.
Okay.
In the face of anyone who challenges her. So, it's going to be hard to hide Dany, I think.
So, when I got this email, I started off with, like, well, kind of a Ned dismissal. Like, this guy's an honorable man. He wouldn't do that. But the thing about Jorah is he's complicated because
he
became a slaver for the love of a woman by his own admission. So would he kill an unborn child for the love of a woman? I mean, I don't think so. I think he's kind of like in a situation where Dany got flung to the ground. Her baby was coming. He didn't know what to do with babies. And
right.
I don't know.
He said, a baby, get it out of here.
There wasn't anyone in this 100,000 strong Kalasar that knew anything about birthing babies
at this
point.
I guess not. Yeah, it's just the witch or nothing.
maybe he thought that the Drogo's blood riders would put a kibosh on the whole thing. I don't know. I guess I just personally discount the theory that he did harm to Dany's baby by any kind of action or inaction, because I think his love of her would encompass her love for her unborn child.
Yeah.
So.
And her desire to take Westeros. I mean, he's essentially destroying that opportunity if he kills his child, right?
I guess. But again, like, I don't know how calculated this decision is supposed to be.
Right.
Because if you want to protect her, like, keeping her from invading Westeros is job number one. Like,
okay.
convincing her to go lead a quiet life of wealth and you know, opulence and...
If you just want her to survive, but if you want her to accomplish her goals...
Right. And again, like, what kind of man do you think Jorah is?
Right.
So, and he himself muddies that water. So I guess...
the answer is I don't know.
Yeah. Julian F., I just watched the season one finale and have some questions for you, but mostly about the end. Do you think Dany knew that she wouldn't burn, and do you think that she knew the dragons would hatch? Or was it just a hunch that she had? What do you think, just from a show watcher's perspective? Because I actually found a nicely answered question on Quora, of all places.
Oh. Hmm.
From an internet user named Nick Yee, that had some quotes from the books that I think shed some light on that. But what do you, just from a show watcher's perspective, what do you think?
So here's the thing. I think Dany knows that she will not burn in this fire, because the scene right before she walks into this fire is her saying, everybody follow me. Like, you're all free, but you're going to follow me, and I'm going to give you the screams of your enemies. Mm-hmm. And then she walks into the fire. Now, right. If she was not sure that she would come out of that, or at least had a pretty good idea that she would come out of it, a feeling.
Right.
Why give this speech before she does this?
And they also...
She implies that she's going to survive this, so...
With the steaming hot bath and her fishing the dragon egg out of the fire that burnt her slave girl, right. Like, those, these are
and
all...
And having this, like, dragon-style baby, like...
And she also, the reason that her slave girl got burnt is because she was shoving her dragon's eggs in the brazier to begin with, which, right. You know...
Why was she doing that?
Why was she doing all that? You know, that's... Yeah. That's if
she's got some gut feeling here that I don't think she quite understands, but it's leading her.
And if you read the history of the Targaryens, it's replete with people trying to hatch dragon eggs or bring about dragons or become dragons by doing crazy things like throwing themselves in a fire or drinking wildfire, setting their fucking summer home on fire, all kinds of things with fire. So... As a Targaryen, I'm sure she has heard her brother tell stories about that, so that might be, like, something that she would do.
Yep.
Do you want to hear from Nick here?
Sure.
He says, in the book, A Game of Thrones, it's implied that Daenerys had a strong suspicion that this or a similar ritual was needed to hatch the dragon. Relevant quotes. When Daenerys orders Miri Mazdur to be tied to the pyre, Daenerys says, it's not your screams I want, only your life. I remember what you told me, only death can pay for life.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty strong that she expected something to happen from this experiment. Two, she had experimented placing the eggs on the brazier earlier in the book. She guessed that she needed bigger fire. And the quote is, she had sensed the truth of it long ago. Dany thought as she took a step closer to the conflagration, but the brazier had not been hot enough. So she thought she was onto something. She just needed a bigger fire. And he says, it's also not clear whether she intended to actually walk into the flames. In the book, it's implied that the fire seduced her to walk into the pyre. And he quotes, Ser Jorah was shouting behind her, but he did not matter anymore. Only the fire mattered. The flames were so beautiful, the loveliest things that she had ever seen. So his conclusion is that she meant to do something like this, but maybe in the end she didn't. She didn't think that the fire, she wasn't thinking about climbing on the fire. She's going to have the eggs there and the witch is going to die and it's going to hatch them. But then she, you know, Targaryen crazy took over and she decided to jump in at the last minute.
Okay.
And the thing is, I think all this stuff is supported in the show too, because they showed the brazier experiment. They showed her continually kind of showing a resistance to fire. I think you can kind of put the two and two together.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for non-spoiler. We still have a fairly robust spoiler section, and we're running long anyway, so shall we cue up the music and get on to it?
Yeah, let's do it. If you want to send your feedback for, I guess, the recap we're doing next week?
We are doing a season one recap, where we're going to talk about differences from books to the show in a non-spoiler format. We're going to talk about just any final thoughts, and I don't know whether it could be a 10-minute episode or it could be another 2-hour. Who knows? But it's tradition, so we're going to do the wrap-up podcast.
Yeah. So get at us on forums.baldmove.com or send your emails to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. And if you're interested in spoilers, we'll see you after the music. If not, see you next week. And until then, I'm Jim.
Well done, Aaron.
And we're back with the spoiler section. What do we got?
So we talked about Rickon having a touch of the green sight.
Okay. Yeah, we can talk all about that now, huh?
Yeah. In the books, all of the Stark children, except for maybe Sansa, have some sort of, as you're a reader, you understand that they have a connection, a psychic connection to their wolves. And I forgot how many instances in the first season where they kind of play with that.
Yeah.
But it seems like they quickly discounted it because, I mean, there's an early scene in season two where Rob's leading his men into battle where they shoot something through the POV of his wolf, and then they show his, like, kind of suggesting that maybe he's seeing things through the eyes of his wolf, and that's why he's got such unnaturally good battle instincts, because he's essentially using his wolf as a scout. Okay. But there is, in the books, there's Arya having dreams about Nymeria, and, you know, of course, you've got all the stuff with Bran that kind of goes down. Jon has a lot of wolf dreams about Ghost. And in the show, they don't really do any of that. They don't even use Ghost as a way to store Jon Snow's consciousness when he's dead. Like,
right.
They just abandoned that idea. What do you think about that?
I mean, I haven't read the books.
Is that just Martin's razor, where they're just like, this ultimately, like, the greatest fulfillment of this plot might be Ghost being used to bring back Jon Snow. What if we just bring him back? And also, like, Arya might have a connection to Nymeria, but what if we just make her an assassin and run around in Riverlands? Like, they could just be like, hey, this was awesome, but we can simplify it, and we can cut 20 minutes out of her, you know.
Yeah, how much does it really matter
that
you can see through a ghost's eyes, or
that all the Stark children have some kind of wolf connection? Like,
right, unless there's an impact on the story.
Exactly.
Who cares?
That's just more surface detail that you can enjoy as a book reader.
Yeah, and maybe there's so much of that in season one because they needed 93 more pages or whatever.
Right.
After the fact. But I mean, to me, I haven't felt like, oh, that's a thing missing, like the connection to the dogs in these six seasons.
Right.
Everything else has been pretty good, so. Right.
So have you seen, the famous internet, Photoshop of like the scene on the Hoth base where Leia's kissing Luke, the cheese off Han, and they Photoshop, Obi-Wan Kenobi's ghost in the background going, oh, like
sure,
that.
Yeah.
I felt very much that same emotion when I was watching Theon say, am I your brother now and always? Like, this is really fucking tragic. Like, the Starks almost instilled enough honor and integrity into him that this was going to be a net good, but we know what happens eventually, and that's all terrible.
Do we know what happens eventually? What are you talking about?
I mean, the fact that he betrays Rob because he goes to his family, and he's got a choice between whether he wants to stand by his quote-unquote brother or make his father that he probably doesn't even remember.
That's
proud.
Season 2, season 3.
Yeah, happens in season 2. I think it's a betrayal.
I remember very little of 2 and 3.
Okay. Well, that's why we're going to have to eventually do a rewatch, Jim.
Yep.
So I thought that was just like, oh, God, this, you know, it's the only brother that's standing beside him, and he's going to twist a knife in his back. The other thing I want to talk about is fucking Shay. You mentioned that you don't connect with her plot, and you think that this is, like, Tyrion is being so stupid. In the book, it's transparently, like, everyone knows that Tyrion's being played by this woman except for fucking Tyrion. And he takes these progressively larger and larger risks.
Ugh.
And it's like, oh, Jesus. And the show, and I've heard it from multiple people, that both Martin and the Double Ds were impressed by her presence and acting to give her a little bit more of a three-dimensional plot and to make it ambiguous about her real feelings for Tyrion and whether she was looking out for him and Sansa and all that. I can't stand the character of Shay.
I know.
I think the actress
I remember you
is
talking about it.
Barely above replacement level, if that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you cast Roz in Shay, and I'm instantly 3,000% more invested, or anyone that is that can... I don't know. Like, is there a universe where Shay can be enjoyed as a character, or was I super colored from my book experience where she was kind of one note and one dimensional? Like, what is your thought on Shay looking back?
It's tough to say because now I don't like Shay because of all the stuff she put Tyrion through, which Tyrion's my favorite character. So how could I not have a bias against her? So I don't know. Like, looking back, did I think,
so even with the show cheating and trying to make her more appealing, you still don't like her? That kind of answers my question.
Well, I don't like her for the reasons that she, in the end, betrayed Tyrion and, you know, got him in a whole lot of trouble.
Do you think that she actually loved Tyrion?
I think so. But you're right. The performance, I don't think, is all that convincing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, It's not that it's not convincing. It just it feels a little stilted.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like the love is a little forced.
Yeah.
Like, but I guess that's the nature of the thing when you start out as a whore, right? You're, there's always going to be that question of, does she really love him?
Yeah.
Like, how much of the money has turned to feelings here?
I just think the way they played her as, like, she's just a spoiled brat. Like, how dare you? And, like,
Every turn.
I think it would have been better if she had just, like, quietly been resigned to her fate, but very sad.
Well, that's the thing I said about it in season four.
I could see Tyrion, like, being moved by pity and the fact that, you know, this is very reminiscent of what happened with his first wife. But, like, her just essentially henpecking him into taking her to King's Landing, that makes Tyrion,
and then that relationship continuing to just stew there for a very long time, because I remember talking about this in I think season four, were we doing the podcast then? I think
yeah,
we were.
That was our inaugural, wasn't it? Or was it season three?
I think it was. It was season four. And I talked about how much, like, she just didn't understand the position she was in. Like, Tyrion's not trying to make you feel bad,
right,
when he says you can't come to me with to the fucking feast or whatever.
Yeah, he's not saying
I'm gonna get my head lopped off, you're gonna get killed, and all this is gonna go to shit, like, right now if you poke your head out of this room.
Yeah, this is not
he's trying to keep you alive.
This is not Kanye being embarrassed that he can't take his whore to the fuck, and I'm not talking about his current wife, it's Amber or whatever. He wrote a song about it, about not being able to get her a dress on Oscar day because of how embarrassed this is. Like, no, we'll all be killed,
right?
We'll all be sentenced to death. You
and Shay never understood those stakes, or she never appeared
but
to.
She did. That's the thing. She did, because she brings the, you know,
and yet she still acted so impetulantly
because,
like,
she was
so
ready
bratty.
She was ready to fucking cut people up to save Sansa, who she also hates. So she has a lot more complex character, but you're right. Like, it seems like they needed for the plot of the book to keep her being a gold-digging whore. Okay. But they also, for whatever reason, wanted to give her more to play, and it ended up being a mess, a contradictory mess of a character that I don't even think played that well.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay.
In the end, I did not like Shay, and it wasn't just because she betrayed Tyrion. It was the portrayal of the character, too.
Yeah. One of these days, I'm going to have to hit you, like, maybe for the preview podcast of next year, like we did for last year, where I read some hot, you know, because you went in completely book virgin.
Yeah, that fat pink mask.
And I deflowered you with the fat pink mask, and I hit you with a bunch of other, like, you know, Jon Snow's actually, you know, all the stuff.
Right.
Yeah. I opened your eyes to a bunch of different things. I want to go the whole, all these crazy theories about Varys, like...
Oh, boy.
Him being a possible mirror person, the fact that he could be actually a woman in disguise, and...
A mirror person?
Like mermaid. He'd be a
merman. Merwoman, whatever he is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
At that point, does he
even have a gash? That's what I want to know.
He's got a cloaca. But this, I perked up a little bit when I heard the Littlefinger say, "I've always imagined you have a gash like a woman's," because I'm like, aha, Littlefinger's been reading the crazy tinfoil conspiracy theory threads on A Song of Ice and Fire subreddit as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, today is not that day. Just, you know, I did actually covered this in the spoiler edition way back in like season four, the whole Varys is a mer person and crazy Varys theories. The other question I had before we get to the feedback is, what the hell happened to Gendry? Like,
where'd he go?
Even Martin's lost the plot of this. Like, they really build him to be a significant character with a lot of memorable traits and scenes, and then fucking nothing.
Yeah.
Like, I really don't understand, what is he going to be significant? What's your gut tell you about his significance?
So Lancel came back after a very long time being absent.
Right.
I'm figuring, yeah, Gendry is probably going to come back. And I mean, you know, all the jokes about him and his shoulders, whatever.
Well, now that Arya is this master assassin in Riverlands, we know that the Brotherhood Without Borders, the Brotherhood Without Banners are also in the Riverlands. Mm-hmm. They had a really strong connection, like maybe that they'll have some Gendry's with the Brotherhood now.
Up, yeah.
Like that could be like an ultimate team up.
Yeah.
That would be interesting, I suppose. Did you have any things you want to talk about, or should we get to feedback?
Let's get to feedback.
Okay. Aaron C. says, in the point at the end, you mentioned that it might be a plot hole that the Whites were able to get through the wall in season one, but could not in later seasons due to the magical properties of the wall. But what if the magic of the wall was strengthened by the reappearance of dragons? In later seasons, at least in the book, I can't remember if it's in the show, Tyrion asked the pyromancers to make wildfire, which he eventually used in the Battle of the Black Water. The alchemists expect to have difficulty making large quantities, but to their surprise, they do not. One comments that it's not been so easy to perform spells since there were dragons in the world. Something about the existence of dragons strengthens the magic of the world, so in theory it could have been reactivated to magic of the wall. The whites could get through easily in season one where there was no dragons, but not later on when there were. This is actually a super compelling theory, because that's not just, I mean, the witches, the warlocks in Qarth. I think even Melisandre says that her magic has gotten stronger since the dragon. Like, many people have noted that, like, magic seems to be returning to the world. So I guess this is the leading theory. If you have to have a magical explanation for it, what do you think?
I suppose that could be true.
Like, essentially, this was the indoor force field turned off.
Right.
And then the dragons came back and it powered back on. What's the rebel fleet going to do now?
Man, they should have been... I mean, they've had hundreds of years, right? They've never sent, like, probes to test that wall. I mean, how long have the dragons been gone?
Well, but that's the thing. We don't, again, we don't understand the magical time clock of the White Walkers either.
Right.
Because, you know, yes, why have they been fallow for these 8,000 years? Mm-hmm. There's got to be some reason. So maybe these dragons, all this stuff is connected.
They missed their window.
It's like, you know, it's a question, would the dragons have hatched if the White Walkers weren't coming? I don't know.
Maybe it's the White Walkers who bring the magic.
Could be.
Not the dragons.
But then if that's the case, then the wall would have already worked. So the dragons bring the magic. The White Walkers
maybe
bring the dragons.
Maybe it's the case of the spell. The closer they get to the wall, the more force the field has.
I get it. It's an apocalyptic party and it's BYOB or BYOD. Yeah. Bring your own dragons.
All right.
Aaron, double Aaron P, said, I think the thing that gets missed is his, Gurm's, actual quote on the topic. This is... got a lot of people talking about Danny's magical fire resistance. You know that's my favorite topic in the world.
Oh, boy.
But he actually happened to quote something that's my favorite quote. This is something from the So Spake Martin Archives, which, if you don't know, is something on Citadel.org where they've essentially taken every email, every con appearance or speaking or any statement that Martin's made in an interview and have, like, assembled it in, like, a Bible-type thing with chapter and verse that you can quote.
They've held him up to an impossible standard.
Yes. So the Inquisitor, Granny, I don't know what the background on this, asked, do Targaryens become immune to fire once they bond to their dragons? George Martin. Granny, thanks for saying that. It gives me a chance to clear up a common misconception. Targaryens are not immune to fire, all in caps lock. The birth of Dany's dragon was a unique, magical, wondrous miracle. She is called the Unburnt because she walked into flames and lived, but her brother sure as hell wasn't immune to that molten gold. Another character called Raven She says, so she won't be able to do it again. This must be some kind of AOL forum chat. George Martin responds, probably not. Aaron continues, probably not is probably just Martin being coy at his fans and not trying to give away the coming burning of the cows. Furthermore, Dany having gone through that unique magical process could have permanently given her properties that no Targaryen has or maybe ever had. After all, in A Dance with Dragons, she survives the fire of Drogon with only her hair burnt off, just like the funeral pyre. In Dance with Dragons, she her hands get burnt, too, because she's got them wrapped in rags. But his conclusion is both the books and the show, Targaryens are not immune to fire, but Daenerys is immune to fire. I mean, it's whatever you want to believe, man. George Martin said absolutely not. The double Ds have conclusively proved this to be true. And this is where this canon discussion we had in non-spoiler thing comes into play. Because... it's my understanding that how Dany escapes from the Khalasar in season 6 is not going to be how she does it in the books. It's also my understanding that, like, Cersei does not burn the Great Sept of Baelor and kill everyone in a fire. Like, that's something the double Ds riffed on. So,
wow.
Those are pretty big events that are going to go down differently. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you got what is canon? Is Dany fireproof or isn't she?
Yeah.
In the show, she definitely is. That's
no
longer up for debate.
Yeah, she is, because I've only seen the show. But
again, there is no debate to it. It's like, what do you want to believe, man? Is it the books have primacy or the show? Because that tells you the answer. Audrey T. said, the books and the show spend a lot of time focusing on bastards and their place in society, which, of course, pretty much at the bottom. Bastards' lots are lamented throughout the series on how they can't inherit lands or money or even have a family last name. Most of the bastards we have met have been young, single boys without a mother around, such as John, Ramsay, or Gendry, and have been illegitimate children of noblemen. I get how being a bastard of a lord or king can be complicated, but what about all the thousands of small folk bastards scattered throughout the land? You can't tell me that even without having such an undesirable start, that none of them have become successful. What happens when Bob Snow falls in love with a non-back alley Sally and they get married? Does she become Sally Snow? Do their legitimate children become Snows? Wouldn't that be incredibly confusing? I've read the books, but I don't remember this ever coming up. Is there any reference to what happens to bastards when they grow up and start their own families? Jim, do you have any thoughts?
No one will marry a bastard in Westeros. They're too low.
Not even a back alley Sally.
No.
You got to know. That's the first thing they'd say. Do you know your father? Do you have two coppers? Okay, let's go. You never get to the two copper phase.
No.
If you don't know. It's not John. That's the thing. Like, Jon Snow is a virgin by choice, but turns out he never got to the two copper phase.
It wasn't his choice.
No. Yeah, it was a choice. It just wasn't his.
I don't know. Like, this is too close to, like, the king lineage question for me to answer. I don't fucking know.
So here's my take. Yes, it's true that common folk and bastard born eventually, sometimes they do great things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, Bronn. He starts off as just Bronn of father, you wouldn't know him. He ends up becoming Sir Bronn of the Blackwater. Mm-hmm. And then he becomes Bronn Stokesworth when he marries into the Stokesworth castle. Mm-hmm. Like, you get a last name when you kind of deserve one. Otherwise, because I think people think of, like, the medieval times as, like, the current, like, everyone's got names in their phone book. Like, in the village, like, if you had Bob Snow and he married Jane Sands, their child would be called, you know, so-and-so son of Bob. Like, Tywin was son of Tytos. Like, you always... Mm-hmm. And that's good enough in a fucking village. If you become famous outside your village, then you get, like, oh, well, that's Bob of the chopped-off nose, or that's Bob Shitsucker, or that's whatever.
Right, the Fleabottom people don't have houses to...
Yeah.
To signify, right?
Right.
With the name Lannister, or the name Stark, or...
Right. Or you'd probably, if you needed to, you'd say, oh, you need to go see Bob the Blacksmith. You know, if you're trying to direct to some Bob, you know, because there's only one, there's certainly not that many blacksmiths in town, and certainly probably only one Bob. If there's two Bobs, well, that's a problem. But I feel like that's, you know, and that's still the way a lot of cultures work. Like, you see, you know, like, isn't a Scandinavian still have, like, they if part of their surnames is son and daughter, like, your last name is, like, if my kid's last name was, you know, he'd be, like, Aronson. Like, Leif Erikson was the son of Eric.
Yeah.
Grimm's daughter is the daughter of Grimm. Like, that's just the way they roll, because it's good enough when all you need to know is the people in your village.
Right.
So there. I hope that helps. It's not a... I didn't research the world of ice and fire. Could be a better answer. That's mine. Pepe M says, knowing what we know happens in the future, do you think that Shae was Tywin's whore and that Tyrion unwittingly stole from his father? This may explain a whole lot of reasons for Tywin's behavior towards Tyrion going forward. Also, there's, of course, a great bit of irony to it all.
Hmm.
So, Bronn stole the whore from a great lord.
Yeah.
Is it possible that's Tywin?
Would Bronn recognize Tywin?
Is Bronn dumb enough to walk into the biggest tent and the guy with the gold lion epaulets and breastplates,
with the deer half skinned on the table,
and slap him around and take his whore, and then that's the end of the matter? That's what you got to ask yourself.
Yeah,
like, does Tywin meekly accept? Does he just rub his cheek and, like, that guy was rude, or does he go fucking tent to tent and make an example of the guy who stole his whore?
No, I think the latter.
One thing that complicates the issue is Tywin's famously anti-whore. That's one of the shocking things. And when Tyrion found out that he'd taken Shae to bed, that, like, all that was a lie.
So maybe he's doing
would
it
he be
in
so
secret.
But still, he'd make an example of you in secret, right? Like, he doesn't just let that go.
Yeah, I mean, certainly he knows about the whore.
Yeah,
if it were his whore, he would not let Tyrion just get away with that. I wouldn't think.
Now, the bigger question, which I was fiercely and hotly contested all throughout, like, seasons 3 and 4, is Shae Tywin's whore in the sense that he is paying her to spy on him and ultimately be the undoing of his son?
Right.
That, especially in the show, is a much more interesting question. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a definitive answer.
Yeah, like when does Shay... Because eventually she turns to Tywin's side. Yep. She's swayed by him somehow. We don't really see how.
Right. Varys is probably involved.
She's either so jilted that she goes to Tywin and helps him plan this, or Tywin pays her or forces her
somehow.
There's
a pretty cool theory that Varys is actually behind all this, because Varys is the one that's actively hiding Shay and helping Tyrion use the secret tunnels in King's Landing to get back and forth through the whorehouse and the mansion that he's got her posted up in, and that, you know, who benefits from Tyrion going over to be Dany's counselor? You know, if he dropped a dime to Tywin about this, like, there's a lot of signs that point that maybe this is Varys manipulating Tyrion behind the scenes.
Could be.
But yeah, so my gut tells me that she's not Tywin's whore, that she just, you know, when Tyrion could no longer provide her the lifestyle that she wanted, she decided to offer her services to highest bidder, which was Tywin.
Yeah.
But I couldn't prove that.
Right.
So, Corbin says, after rewatching episode 109, Baelor, I can't help but think that Baelish had something to do with Joffrey's decision to behead Ned. When Ned is brought to the Sept and looks up at the council, Baelish seems to have an extra squirrely smirk on his face. After Joffrey announced his decision, Baelish doesn't persuade him to reconsider. In fact, he has no reaction at all. I was just wondering if you think Littlefinger was involved in the decision. What do you think, Jim?
So, I don't know if there's really anything to support that he was, like, directly involved, but I think this might be the outcome. He can live with this outcome, and I think that's why he maybe doesn't jump in there to try and persuade him, because he's already gone to Ned and tried to get him to do what he wants, and Ned's gone, nope, too honorable for that. Right. See ya, Baelish.
Right.
So maybe he's happy to see Ned out of the picture.
Right.
Bring in somebody new, bring in Jaime, bring in the Hound, whoever.
Right.
But I don't know if he... I really don't see any indication that he is part of the decision.
I researched this, and I looked, and the books all point to the fact they very conspicuously say that, like, Varys is losing his shit.
Right.
Cersei is losing his shit. Littlefinger, Pycelle is kind of losing his shit. Littlefinger is conspicuous in that he is not mentioned as losing his shit.
Mm-hmm. And in the show, the same
thing. In the show, they do the same thing. So they kind of brought that. I can't remember what all he confessed to Sansa. I don't know that. Obviously, being complicit in killing her father is not something he would confess. So never mind. But no, I think the evidence shows that, yes, he had, and I think Varys, I know in the books, but maybe in the show, tries to reason with Tyrion that, like, you know, who put it into the king's head to do this when all of his advisors said no.
Right.
And, you know, something that I think Tyrion dismissed ultimately, but Varys, I think, thinks that Littlefinger did it. Now, Varys could have a vested interest in just making Littlefinger look bad. You know, he's jockeying for position of being a trusted advisor here. So they clearly, even if they have a mutual quote unquote respect, they still jockey for power. So but my gut says that he probably was, because else why, you know, is Joffrey that bloody minded that he would literally not listen to any of his advisors and just go rogue like this?
I mean, we talked about how he might be trying to instill fear in his followers. I mean, the crowd's chanting for his head.
Right.
It's possible that Joffrey gets too wrapped up in it and goes for it.
He also has a history. I mean, we think that he went rogue on the attempt on Bran's life after he is pushed out of the, for whatever reason that made sense in his head. So, I think it's probably more plausible that Littlefinger wasn't involved, though. But again, I couldn't prove it in a court of law.
Yeah.
Cody S., how do you think Gendry will return before the climax or afterwards? We already talked about that.
In a boat.
So, yeah, probably Rowan. And you thought he was jacked blacksmithing? Yeah. Well, wait until you see his rowing routine. Also, before season 6 is desired...
Oh, speaking of being jacked, now I understand why everybody was like, holy fuck, Lancel got ripped.
Oh.
Because I forgot how bird-like he was in season 1, and he comes back and he is jacked.
Yeah, he had this little... He became a man full grown.
Yeah.
Cody says, also before season 6, it was desired mine that an amazing subversion of storytelling would be that Ramsay somehow becomes a hero and aids in the defeat of the White Walkers should they cross the wall. Because up to that point, he hadn't totally been beyond redemption and helping of others in the common cause of defeating the final boss. Yes, he was evil, but he could he overcome this? And Nagus parenthetically says his nature versus nurture.
Who would have a
Ramsay
role in this?
Bolton.
Ramsay, oh. Okay.
And he continues quickly, but then they ramped up his vileness to the point where I knew he wasn't going to make it and was beyond turning around. But now I'm thinking about Littlefinger. Do you think he could still be redeemed? Could he help against the White Walkers, or is my desire to see a villainous character turn good slash unexpected hero unwarranted, and it's only going to be the good guys in the finale? First of all, I think you're overlooking the obvious heel face turn of Jaime Lannister.
Right.
Like, that's
right.
Just on, like, he's the villain, and now he's kind of the good guy.
Sure.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely plausible. I mean, Jaime's come a long way since old Jaime. But as far as, like, Littlefinger, I think I probably would have said no halfway through last season 6.
Right.
But the interactions he had with Sansa kind of changed my mind on Littlefinger a little bit.
Hmm.
And I think maybe he could be kind of put in his place and under the thumb of someone in the end.
I think it is, and I've never thought about this until Cody emailed it, but it is kind of an interesting thought that Littlefinger, like, he gets involved in the White Walker War, assuming he survives at that point, and he's incredibly useful because he knows how to raise money, he knows how to influence, he knows, he's like, he's been working to sow unity, if it's his own best interest that they beat the implacable ice zombies.
Obviously.
And wouldn't it be funny if he turned into a legit hero of that war? And, like, almost kind of like the way the Grinch comes, you know, his heart grows three sizes too big that day. Like, him being a hero kind of jazzes him. And he's like, well, maybe I was wrong. And the little guy, and he, like, just kind of becomes a legit hero.
Okay, that's one way to go. Here's another way.
Hit me.
I mean, I could potentially see that. Like I said, he kind of surprised me in season 6. The other way is he becomes an unwitting hero. He's just doing his Littlefinger thing, trying to gain power, trying to gain wealth, and that happens to help the realm fight off the Walkers.
Right. So that's a little bit, that's a slightly different nuance than I was going for.
Right, right.
Like, instead of like, well, I have to put aside my schemes to help the realm because I can't let the realm be taken over by these alien beings, he's still playing his game, but it turns out that those are winning moves for the war against the White Walkers.
Right, and maybe he's aware of that, and he understands that this also helps the realm, but he's going to get his too.
No, that's interesting. We spend a lot of time talking about who the good characters are going to fall. Is it going to be Danny? Is it going to be John? Is it going to be fucking Bran? It's going to be Bran. I know it.
Oh,
but we don't spend a lot of time talking about the redeemable villains either.
Right.
So,
but yeah, you're right on Jaime. He's coming around. I hope he does.
Seems to be a number one redeemed villain. I'd almost say Tyrion, except for I don't think Tyrion was ever villainous. Like, you were,
I don't
he
think
was
so either.
Out and out point of view protagonist from the beginning.
Yeah.
Kyle says, I have some thoughts about whether Jorn is breaking his vows by saving Arya. First of all, this is a question we debated last week. First of all, if the North is the only kingdom that holds any substantial respect for or provides any real support to the Night's Watch, it would make sense that they would also hold a healthy respect and appreciation for the Lords of the North. Given Jorn's traveling job, also, it would make sense that he knew Ned pretty well and called on his hospitality often. There's probably a part of him that felt honor-bound to preserve the safety of one of his order's true remaining friends. Further, we already know that many men of the Night's Watch spend their nights away from the Wall in brothels, and why wouldn't they if their watch is a sentence? After some thought, I'm beginning to see Yoren's actions as the first but subtle breaking of vows for the good of the Watch or the realm. Maybe Arya's life would be rewarded by badly needed resources at the Wall. Maybe the honor of saving a child outweighed the loss of honor in getting involved in politics. Examples of honorable black brothers breaking their vows. Sam, for all intents and purposes, takes a wife, and John, now a widower, carries out some of his Lord Commander duties, such as hanging the betrayers, before saying the words ending his watch and setting out. I mean, why are none of the Northern Lords asking, what are you doing here, deserter? I sentence you to death. You're right. Like, that's some of these conversations we had kind of in the context of, being fun for the season 1 only watchers, because you're right. Like, if you look at the history of the Night's Watch, even what Jor says in this episode, like, we kind of know that dudes go and fuck whores in Moletown and do other stuff that we're not aware of. And, John transgresses, Sam transgresses, everybody does. So
yeah,
it's a little less of a hot take now.
Right. It's not necessarily, you know, about whether or not he is breaking his vows, but whether or not that's permissible.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I do think that, yes, they serve the whole realm, but also they probably give a little bit more juice to what the Northern Lords say, because, as he mentions, they are their primary benefactor and supporter.
Right.
And they probably have to give, you know, obviously they can't piss off the king, because the king can come up there with a large army and kick their ass in. So,
sure.
You know, but if they have to decide whose request to grant between, say, Ned Stark and Tywin Lannister, I bet Tywin Lannister gets a lot of, oh, we regret to inform you that we cannot.
Yeah.
Although Tywin probably never writes a Night's Watch anyway.
No.
Chris M. says, I don't like picking on economic and science details in story if they matter, if they, I don't like picking on economic and science details and stories if they matter to the story, but the Night's Watch could easily be fully staffed if the idiot lords and King's Landing just made slightly harsher laws for stuff like minor theft.
Right.
You'd have the jails filled in a week. Everyone would win, since, one, the walls properly manned, two, the population venting of King's Landing, and three, guarding the walls likely better than living in Fleabottom. Careful, you're starting to sound like a CCA executive. What is the financial gain of putting people in prison? You know, they can make tons of license plates for free and take them off. Yeah, it's... you're right. They could make spitting on the sidewalk or shitting in the streets illegal and swell the ranks of the Night's Watchmen, but...
Season 7.
Yeah. But also, I wonder what the implication would be of being, like, if... So Jor is able to rule over a small number of rogue black brothers with a couple of hand-picked lieutenants that are in power. Could he oversee, like, a slave army of 10,000 criminals? Like, I wonder if the scale even works at that point.
How do you feed all those people up there?
Yeah, I used to got to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't come for free necessarily, but...
Yeah. I mean, that you're presupposing that the entire realm is behind the Night's Watch, which I think you, if that was true, you'd have a whole bunch of volunteers and tributes and all kinds. Like, it'd be a properly staffed army.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, if things weren't the way they were, then... Dave McBee says, I always thought that Miri Mazdur tricked Dany into the blood magic for the purpose of not really helping Drogo. After all, she offers to heal his wounds first, and Drogo, his portmanteau of zombie Drogo, was always part of her plan. I also thought that she caused the early labor and deformity of Rego as part of his death. She mentioned that when Dany saved her, she'd already been raped multiple times and her village burnt. According to the Game of Thrones wiki, she didn't want Drogo or the stallion that mounts the world to cause more suffering, so the only option was to kill them.
I mean, yeah, I think if I'm the witch in that scenario, I really lean into the stallion thing, and I make him have hooves, and I make him have a tail, and
sure,
long hair.
She went dragon.
Yeah.
Odd thing, do you think this is literally true? That, like, Dane, because, like,
I think
that's,
so.
Because it's one thing that's interesting is that the actual depiction of Dany's unborn child roughly matches the popular depiction of how Tyrion looked when he was born.
Oh, okay.
Which a lot of people have used to, you know, further the Tyrion as a dragon rider, secret Targaryen theory. But it's a weird similarity. Like, you didn't look like a baby the way an actual Targaryen did look. QED, you're a hidden Targaryen.
Right. Like, it's weird.
Yeah,
because we know it's not true about Tyrion.
Right.
So
it's a literary connection between the bloodlines, I guess. But yeah, anyway. Plus, also, Tyrion's a lot more stunted and fucked up in the books than he is played by Peter Dinklage, who is a conventionally handsome and fairly proportionate dude. Mm-hmm. Dave McBee. Okay, we already talked about his email. Zach T. I was curious about the reveal showing Grand Maester Pycelle is more spry and sharp-witted than he appears after Roz leaves his chambers. When I first watched this part, I assumed that the showrunners were getting at something important that wasn't there in the books or that I didn't pick up on. I didn't think it was coincidence that the scene was directly followed by the two other small council members, Varys and Littlefinger, hinting that they're indeed up to more than they let on. So let's skip ahead, because we talked about a lot of this. Mm-hmm. He wants to know, was this dedicated ruse all for nothing then? Did it really not go beyond attracting undeserved pity from members of the court and prostitutes to avoid subjects of payment? If they were, there's a fine line between not wanting to present yourself to the powerful as too competent or ambitious and not wanting to present yourself as too useless, mm-hmm. which Pycelle was at risk of doing. Do you think the Double Ds were originally planning something more elaborate?
I don't know. This is in the books too, yeah?
No.
No?
No. His artificial spryness or decrepitude is not a part of the books. So
I don't think it's paid off in any significant way.
In season three, I think, of the Blu-rays, they have the deleted scenes. Mm. As a deleted scene of Tywin Lannister fishing at King's Landing, which kind of harkens back to him butchering a deer. Like, he's a rugged outdoorsman when he's not being a Machiavellian leader of the people. And Grandmaster Pycelle stoops up to him and does all these, tells all this shit, and Tywin says something to the effect of, "And stop with the hunchback bullshit." And Pycelle straightens up and says, "As you wish, my lord." And they both kind of share like a, "Oh, you," kind of look. And that's the only thing I can think of, is that they wanted to have this in their back pocket for Tywin to smoke out, to make another example of Tywin being the smartest guy in the room, that he knows even, like, to suggest that he knows his sycophants' even most closely guarded secrets.
Hmm.
But it was a deleted scene, and like by this point, Tywin has already manifestly demonstrated how badass he was on numerous occasions.
Yeah, seems like a good deleted scene. Maybe they thought, yeah, they'd need it, but I don't think they did.
Yeah.
I'm glad they cut it.
Yeah, because, you know, again, in the books, you have lots of interior monologues of Jaime and Tyrion and Cersei and everyone talking about how fucking awesome Tywin was, and maybe they thought...
Right.
Like, we talked about how they did a lot of showing, not telling this season, with, like, little quirks of the character that tells you a lot about them.
Yeah.
But they didn't use it, so I don't know if it was something more elaborate, or it's just like, hey, we think it's beneficial to be underestimated by other people. Charlie from Long Island says, "You guys have recently discussed something, someone ordering the books in a chronological chapter sequence. This got me thinking, what if the first shot of the show was the full Tower of Joy scene? We see Ned take the baby from the tower, and by the end of the first season, we figure out it's Jon. How would that impact the rest of your watching, knowing Jon's true heritage, knowing that this guy has a claim to the throne? Would have made it better or worse?"
I feel like it makes Jon's fate at Winterfell a lot more tragic, in that his bastard father's wife is like giving him shit all the time because she thinks it's this bastard baby of Ned's. Like, I feel like I'd probably feel worse for John than I do already.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the same. You could ask the same question about, like, what if you knew from the very beginning that Luke was the chosen one? Like, from the very from his twin sons at Tatooine, he's not just a whiny boy about talking about the moisture farming. He's actually got a little bit more. But to me, that makes both of those stories seem, if you did that, more conventionally Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. Like, this is very, once upon a time there was a boy who was born and his mother died, and now, like, you know, it's like, it's very much more straight up fairy tale, which seems like Martin and Lucas both are trying to avoid, and going more like a Joseph Campbell kind of very steeped in myth and importance and his seeming historicity and stuff like that. That's the only thing I can think of. So I think it would be worse. It would be a lot more Princess Bride and a lot less, you know, uncovering a mystery that even the protagonists don't fully understand.
Yeah, I guess so.
Scott Dubb from Cincinnati says, "Tyrion promised the Hill Tribes dominion over the Vale if they'd help him with the Battle of the Green Fork. Clearly they did their job. Tyrion and the Lannisters have motive to seek revenge against the Tullys, especially with the real risk that they could attack in or ally with in revenge with the Starks. Especially after the War of the Five Kings, there'd be incentive to boot the Tullys and pay their debt to the Hill Tribes. But Littlefinger's later alliance proves that this doesn't happen. What up?" Couple things. I think you're confusing the Tullys with the Arryns.
Right.
And it's confusing because the Tullys married into the Arryns, and they also married into the Starks. They're busy bees this last generation.
Yeah, that is Kat's sister up there in the Vale.
They married off their daughter to two lords paramount. That's
right.
That's pretty sweet. Paramount.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, it wouldn't be revenge on Kat so much.
Yeah.
I mean, just her sister, who's crazy and kind of Kat's pissed at anyway.
Yeah. So if my memory serves in the books, I can't remember what they did in the series, that the Hill Tribe people follow Tyrion to King's Landing and kind of intimidate the Hell. Like, that's his private security force. Mm-hmm. And then as he slowly finds less and less need for them, he sends them to like, and the War of the Five Kings heats up. He sends them off into the Kingswood, and they just kind of like, you know, pillage anyone that's trying to move across, which is like the Renly Baratheon's forces, mm-hmm. and kind of harass and harry and decide amongst themselves that this is a better life than they lived up in the meager mountains. And I also think that people are way overestimating how much loyalty Tyrion feels to these people, and Tywin too.
Right.
And like, also, as I've said many times, I don't think that even if you armed and doubled their ranks, that they would be able to seriously challenge the Lords of the Vale. Mm-hmm. Like, this, they don't have the technique, they don't have the strongholds, they don't have the techniques, they don't have the supply lines, like all the things you need to fight a war against professional soldiers. They don't have any of that shit.
Yeah, I'm with you. Just send them up there and let them do their thing. They'll get killed.
But it's like, I don't think Martin cares, nor Tyrion or Tywin, about what happened to the Hill Folk. Although, I think there is an answer. Like, I think like half of them went back to the mountains, and half of them decided that, hey, south here in King's Landing is better than living meager existence up in the mountains. BD or Bill D says, there's a connection that stands out that was lost on me the first time around, but I haven't heard you guys mention it. During Kat's negotiation, the shitbag Frey, that's apparently his full name. Part of the result was that Arya was to be married to one of the Frey's sons. Sure. Considering the book showrunner remix of Arya and the Frey pie, I think I like it that she essentially killed and cooked one of the guys that she was supposed to be, her forced arranged marriage partner. Yeah. You cook up your betrothed. That's not a bad way for Arya to go.
Yeah, I like it.
Naomi says, a couple of episodes ago, someone mentioned that it looks like both the White Walkers and Dany are off of Littlefinger's radar. This is my Season 7 prediction. Littlefinger will try to or even end up being on Dany's small council. Somehow, Littlefinger has escaped public scrutiny despite all the schemes he's pulled off over the years. Few people have even raised any suspicions towards him, and the ones who have spoken out against him are either disgraced or dead, such as Ned and Varys. Unlike Tyrion, he still may be well-liked by the public, even by other minor lords. I think Littlefinger, realizing he is on thin ice with Sansa and that Cersei may have gone a bit mad, will seek out Dany and try to join her team. He's already teamed up with one of her current allies, the Queen of Thorns. Littlefinger may offer to help get rid of Cersei as a way to prove his loyalty, quote-unquote loyalty, or insist that he has both the Vale and the North in his hands and convince them to fight for Dany. No one really knows how despicable Baelish is. No one knows his role in the madness that has befallen the kingdom, from the death of Jon Arryn to the betrayal of Ned Stark to the murder of Joffrey. No one, that is, except for Sansa Stark. And then she launches upon kind of like the fanfiction-y type of predictions that we don't, as a rule. It's not a judgment. It's an editorial call.
Right.
But what do you think of it so far? Like, could Varys and Littlefinger be reunited once again?
You know, I would like to see that. I do love their repartee.
Yeah.
I
don't know. The jabs at the severed stump are no longer doing it for you, though.
That's true.
And
that's
the Littlefinger's got lots
but
more
they've
of that
got more.
From.
They've got more than that.
Okay.
That's not all they do. They take jabs at each other's honor and respect and whatnot as well, which I appreciate. And, man, you throw Tyrion, Varys, and Littlefinger in a room. That's a scene I'm gonna like.
Yeah,
I don't think it's impossible.
I mean, don't think Tyrion trusts Littlefinger, and I don't think Varys trusts Littlefinger. So you'd have two of her
but
most
they
trusted.
Respect each other.
okay, do you think they really do? That's something I kind of want. Okay, really,
I do. I do think he has a certain like they each have a certain respect for the other's craftiness. The other's
or their ability
how they
to come
play the
so
game.
Far.
Yeah.
From so little.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't say they want to work together.
You know, I read in unrelated research to this podcast, or I guess related, but I came across in researching some of the questions that the readers had, a theory that when Varys was trying to warn Ned about a talented boy from the Vale who's risen far beyond his means, that he was actually trying to warn him of Littlefinger.
All right.
But Ned leapt to the Sir Hugh theory, and that was kind of like, Varys, like, oh, yeah, you're not as smart as I was hoping you were.
I
will scale my
that.
Support. And I'm like, oh, that's a hot take.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything he says about Sir Hugh also fits Littlefinger, only on a grander scale.
Right.
So, that's my problem with Sansa Stark being the bulwark against this, because I feel like there's already going to be a lot of people being like, no, don't do it, Danny. But on the other hand...
And I'm probably one of those. I think it might be a bad idea long term.
And I definitely think Sansa versus Littlefinger is definitely a fight that I want to see. And I think something that Sansa's going to win. I just don't think the stakes are going to get to Dany before that happens.
Okay.
But I could definitely be proven wrong, Naomi. Jordan L., I was curious on your thoughts about Roz's addition to the show. I'm glad the writers wrote her in, other than for aesthetic reasons that Aaron's interested in.
I gotta say, not bad. Not bad, Roz.
Or do you think she's better left out? What do you think, man?
Better left out?
Yeah, he's saying, are we glad that... Because she's a purely show invention.
Is she? Okay.
She's not a character from the books. Is it a good thing that she's in it, or would we be better off if we left her out?
See, the problem is I don't remember the rest of the series between season 1 and season 4.
Well,
does she affect like Theon's decisions? And
I don't think she defects. She doesn't do anything for Theon. She does get. She tries to play a political game between Littlefinger and Varys and Tyrion, and ends up getting turned over to Joffrey. As a torture plaything. Doesn't end well for her.
I didn't remember how she got there.
So
I don't know. Honestly, I don't remember enough of these two seasons to say.
I've always thought that they included her to be like a commoner's point of view in this, because like all the POVs are from these great people directly being affected, and she's kind of like the viewer in some way. Hmm. Like, or not a viewer, but like a representation of the common man or woman. And I think she's beautiful. I thought that a lot of scenes that she added, some dimensions, and she was, again, you know, what happens when a little person tries to play, apologies to Tyrion, a little person tries to play the Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just no way for her to win. On the other hand, after I heard this interview on that radio station, it seems like maybe she was birthed out of desperation. Because the Double D's are like, we have a lot of this exposition and one-on-one dialogue, and we don't have the character moments for it. And
how do we get into those scenes?
How do we do it? I know. We'll hire a crazy hot redhead to be in the background and just pull details out of Theon and all the other things she did.
Hmm.
And she became a character in her own right. So I'm kind of neutral. I think she's not a necessary part of the story.
Right. She's not in the books, sure.
But she also, I think, made the most of her opportunity, unlike Shay, who was given a much larger, more three-dimensional role, and I think artistically shat the bed.
Okay.
But the Double D's and Martin disagree, so what the hell do I know?
Harsh words.
Telling how it is. Mike, I think this is the last email.
Okay.
No, there's two more. Mike, one thing I love about the show is the cinematic depiction of the different regions, the harshness of Winterfell, the lush greens of the Reach, the vastness of parts of Essos, etc. Rewatching the early season of the show, I'm reminded that the only one of the Seven Kingdoms we haven't seen is Casterly Rock. Considering how important the Lannisters are to the show and how many times we've heard this area mentioned, it seems odd. Were there any parts of the book that were set in Casterly Rock? No, not that I can think of. I know that there is some kind of flashback reminiscing of Tyrion running the sewers. I can't trust my memory of whether that's a show only detail or I know there's also a memorable fantasy, like a dream sequence where Jaime is dreaming that he's lost in like the catacombs of Casterly Rock. I don't think that we've actually seen it. It's described as awesome, like this big rock that's kind of sort of lion shaped. Like in the popular depiction, it's kind of like where Lionel from the fucking Thundercats would hide out. But yeah, I kind of want to see it.
There hasn't been much of a reason to, right? Like, no important events have taken place up there.
Yeah, there's not been a big war fought
in
the Westerlands.
Kevin hangs out there for a while.
He goes.
But who cares about Kevin?
Right when he comes back to King's Landing when he's interesting again.
Right.
He continues. Perhaps the Tyrion returning to Westeros and Jaime seemingly at a crossroads. We'll see some scenes set there in the next season. Yeah, I mean,
and maybe Dany comes and conquers Casterly Rock.
Says,
a big fuck
East
you.
Coast, I'm flying my dragons, I'm doing a rear guard action.
I already got the Dothraki on a boat. That's
right.
The hard part.
Sure. We're just going to keep sailing.
Yeah.
Why not? I guess in the same way that I was excited to see the impressive looking Riverlands this year.
Yeah.
And I love seeing the Erie when we can get a chance to get up there.
Right. You you would have said that about like River Run up until
fairly recently, right? Saw River. I mean, that we've seen River Run before, but like it was super impressive last season. Yeah, no, I would love to see Castle Rock.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to be important, I don't know. Especially in a show where like Castle Rock's broke and played out at this point. Brett R, last one. Question for you. Joffrey said he's still married to Sansa. I can't figure out why. I have to believe that any marital alliance to be gained with House Stark went flying out the window when Joffrey had Stark's head cut off. What possible benefit is there that couldn't also be achieved by keeping her prisoner in a dungeon?
That's a real good question.
I think this is kind of a holding pattern that Cersei's not smart, but smart enough to know that she doesn't understand all the implications of setting aside marriage arrangements and alliances, and it's like, you know, she hasn't even gotten her period yet. She can't give Joffrey any sons. Mm-hmm. You know, she's quickly set aside. So I feel like this is all in the works, but she's not going to do that until like her father shows up to advise her. She's just smart enough, and Joffrey kind of, I think, relishes the idea of tormenting this girl that he's going to marry.
Well, sure.
So he's not like, why am I, you know, shacking up with this traitor? I think it's just that she's not that important to their plans.
Right. I mean, I guess that's what the emailer is pointing out.
Well, the other thing is, you know, the only other thing I can say is that the Lannisters know that they don't have Arya.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might be a little mental calculus of if we're unnecessarily cruel and vicious to Arya or to Sansa, we only have the one. And if we want to trade him for Jaime straight up, like how much goodwill can we burn with the Northerners? But they cut Ned Stark's head off. So
yeah,
like goodwill gone, uh-huh. Like Tyrion said, glass smash. But again, I don't know. I don't think they addressed this. And I think, I can't tell if you're like a first time through type person, Brett, but it's quickly dealt with in later seasons. Like, is she set aside in season 2 or 3?
It's gotta be or 2 or 4, right?
I don't know, because like it's gotta be season 3, because Marjorie Tyrell, the Tyrells come running to the rescue of King's Landing at the end of season 2, the Battle of the Blackwater, which is what...
Right, and Sansa's in that room hold up with Cersei, yes, while the attack's happening.
So then they have the political need to have a marriage alliance between the Tyrells to cement this new relationship, and that's when they set the High Sept and moves the Setter aside and allow Joffrey the difficult decision of taking Margaery Tyrell. I don't know if those answers satisfy you, but they're the ones I have. So that's it for our spoiler section. Comes to a close once again. If you'd like to send us feedback, we got one more week for it, and then we're going on hiatus for a good long while. Not sure when we'll come back, whether it'll be before season 7 or after season 7, but that's when to look for us next, probably.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com if you want to discuss this stuff for one last time before we hibernate for a bit for the real life winter that is coming. We'll be back next week for a wrap up.
All right.
And it'll be largely what the only thing I have planned is a kind of a deep dive of the differences between the books and the show, which I think are kind of... It's weird because it's easier to make a comprehensive list in the early seasons because there's fewer deviations, but the deviations, it's easy to henpeck of like, oh, well, so-and-so did this, and it was this other character, and this character's last name was this, and whereas in the other, once you get into the later seasons, it's like, shit is way different, y'all.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing that's the same is beginning and the end. But I think there was some kind of interesting things. It'll probably be cribbing from the old podcast on that stuff, too, but... Everything else is going to be whatever you guys want to talk about, and we'll see you next week.
See you then.